I'm going to open the House Committee on Business and Labor. And just so you know, today, folks, today's about listening. We will have time for questions, but not a lot. If you can limit them, you know most of the folks on this list. If you don't, we can get you in contact with them. Today's not about taxes. I'm not interested in retroactive taxes or taxes on anyway, we're not talking about taxes today. Gross receipts. I don't like it any more than you do. I didn't vote for it. This isn't the committee to talk about it. And nothing's permanent. People say it's permanent. Nothing's permanent. We're going to talk about all that next year. And nothing's permanent. We're going to make some changes, I'm confident. That's not what today's about.
Mr. Chairman, we're not going to be allowed to whine even?
We're not talking at all. We're listening. And you've got to listen to me for 3 minutes.
I was just going to say.
And today we're going to hear about we're going to hear about some good things.
Can we vote on that?
No, you can't. No, you can't. We all know about being told whether you can vote or not on it. We can talk about it or not. And today you can't talk. So, we're going to hear some good things today, but you know what? We're not doing enough in this state, and everybody in this state knows it. You know, we got a governor that has spent 7.5 years suing the federal government, getting away with timber, opposing good water policy, running off with an activist attorney general who hired a rogue assistant who resigned in scandal, who run off hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of private investment in this state. And it is a scandal. It's a crime. We have 250,000 Oregonians who don't have a job in the state. One in five of every people you walk by in the state is on food stamps. We are the definition of a welfare state, and it's unsustainable. Yet we are awash in natural resources and land and an army of people that know what to do with it in a sustainable, economic, environmental, and socially sustainable fashion. It's a crime. I'm sick of it. I'm not going to impugn my colleagues today, but I can talk about anything I want in the future. And if future legislators and legislatures and governors don't get behind the things we're talking about today, they don't care. They will not be caring about working families and their children in the state of Oregon. I can't impugn people that don't exist. I'm not impugning anybody that exists. I'm talking about the future. And I'm not apologizing for anything I see here today. We're not going to spend. We're not going to cut. We're not going to tax our way out of this problem. We're going to work our way out of this problem. That's it. Now, I'm going to call up some good people that are doing some good things. Lynn Schosler and Chandra Brown. And limit your questions, please. I beg you to limit your questions. We have a long, long... I'm sorry, they get a half hour?
Yeah,
these nice people get a half hour.
I apologize to the rest of you out in the audience.
And sympathy, I hope, for injury, too, okay?
Let's, all right. Thank you. Hi, how are you today?
Fantastic. How are you?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Chandra Brown, and I am the Vice President of Oregon Ironworks, as well as the President of United Streetcar, and I am here today as one of the brand new commissioners, which is why I will not get any hard questions today, because I am probably the newest member on the Business Oregon Commission. And the reason why I've chosen to serve in that capacity is because it is my incredible passion about creating and retaining jobs. As most of you who have probably heard recently, Oregon Ironworks and United Streetcar have been creating jobs. We have just built the first modern streetcar in 58 years. We now have contracts with Tucson and Portland for another $50 million in work and probably another 200 jobs just from streetcars, which is a brand new industry that we are doing in our union workshop. And why I think it's so incredible is because the point of Business Oregon and why we are here today, which I always like to emphasize because it's such a simple mission, and that is about the creation and retention of well-paying family wage jobs in the state of Oregon. And I always like to start out about retention because, obviously, as a company that's been here almost 70 years. We definitely like to take care of our existing folks as well. I think recruitment gets a lot of emphasis and a lot of talk, but the reality of what Business Oregon is doing through the incentive packages and a variety of programs that Lynn is going to talk about, it really is also about retaining and growing our existing base. And I'm not going to go into detail on the programs, and I know we have a huge list of folks that are coming behind. The few things that I just want to touch on today really starts with what makes Oregon competitive, and Chair Schaffer did a lovely job starting out talking about our natural resources and what we have. However, what I think is critical are things like innovation, as well as with the natural resources, it's how we use it. And one of Business Oregon's that I have been involved with, so know more about, is the Oregon Innovation Council. And what they are doing in terms of seafood, green buildings, the nanotechnology, wave energy, I think is setting the grounds for the future of this state and where we're going to move forward and what areas does Oregon specifically have a competitive advantage in. Because we are competing not only internationally, but against the other states. So what Business Oregon is doing with Oregon Inc. is really creating a new framework on how we are going to be innovative and having our existing companies, and by that I mean the existing builders, the existing manufacturers, and how are we transforming into this clean tech and green economy that Oregon is already famous for across the states. In addition to that, I can speak that one of the biggest pressing problems that we need to be addressing from the state and from the Business Oregon perspective is such things as incentives and access to capital. Obviously, without access to capital, especially for small businesses, we will not continue, again, to grow and thrive not only the existing base, but the incentives that will bring the new folks in. We are, as a commission, we did a review of all the incentives. There may be some new incentives eventually coming out that are going to be pro-business and helpful that we'll be bringing forward in the future. But I think that looking at it in a total effect, that really shows where some holes are and where some areas are that we can do better because we need to do better. But I will say what we've done to date with access to capital for small businesses through Business Oregon has truly been a lifesaver for many companies, especially the very small business that this state is predominantly made up of. Finally, I'd say from the recruitment, not just retention, but the recruitment of new companies, obviously with Solar World and some of those, we've been very successful, but it needs to be more successful. But I think that the assistance that Business Oregon is providing for recruitment, and as an example, I like concrete examples, we've had probably 5 international companies in the last 6 months out visiting related to wave energy. And those are companies from Denmark, from the UK, from New Zealand, from Australia. And all of those companies have sent folks here because they believe Oregon is one of the best places in the United States to do business. And right now, internationally, they're slightly ahead of the United States in terms of this specific emerging industry. So that's an example of these other outside foreign companies that are coming to look for headquarters, manufacturing facilities, buildings, what they would be doing here in the state of Oregon. And it's definitely a first mover advantage. So that being said, I would very much like to compliment. I've only been on the commission for a few months now, so just getting my feet wet. But I'm really impressed with the staff and with what limited resources, what's already been done, and I think what can be done better, particularly with what we're going to do in terms of moving these programs forward, as I said, with some of the new incentives and some of the new things that are coming out now that everything's been changed up in the department. With that being said, I think I'm going to introduce Lynn Schessler, who is the Deputy Director of Business Oregon and who's the expert on all the detailed programs information, so he can give you more of that. But I'd also really like to thank all the folks that are in this room behind me because they are the partners. As everyone knows, you can't do it without leveraging. We have limited dollars, limited time in every department in this state, and so what we must do is leverage our partners from the union side, the labor side, the business side, and the natural resources side. So we really appreciate the folks that are here that are going to testify after us and hopefully also be able to answer questions. Thank you very much, Chair and Committee.
Before we move on, can you manufacture bus shelters at your business? Do you have the capacity and ability to do that?
Well, sir, we can manufacture anything at
That's
our
That's what
business.
I wanted to hear right there. Thank you. Go ahead.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director, as Chandra said, of the Business Oregon Department. Director McCabe, I'll just point out, is on a trade mission in China, Korea, and Japan as we speak, and expresses his regrets in not being able to be here today. Let me just reiterate and confirm for you exactly what Chana was saying. 90% of the work we do is with existing Oregon businesses. We certainly like to see the headline, just as you do, of a new business coming to the state, an international recruitment, or stealing a prominent business from another state. And we like those headlines. We see them infrequently, but really what we do 90% of the time is work with an Oregon business. And what we're really focusing right now, as you did in the last session, was to focus on business finance and capital access. As you know, the credit markets have shrunken. You don't see a lot of businesses being able to go to the bank as they used to and get that line of credit and financing. That's where we're trying to step in. We have the Oregon Business Development Fund. It's a revolving loan program. You gave it a shot in the arm with Senate Bill 1017. It recapitalized that effort, and because of that recapitalization, we are moving forward and continually working with businesses. And that's statewide. That's not just a metropolitan or Willamette Valley approach. We are working with businesses in Baker City, Hubbard, John Day, as well as Portland, of course, and further south in Medford. So we do get around the state with that program. Another aspect of our business strategy is also to help businesses with their existing bankers and credit lines by providing essentially a loan guarantee so that that bank is not on the hook for 100% of the loss. If that's a problem, we have a program that helps guarantee that loan that that bank makes to the business. We have grown by $1.25 million in the first quarter of this year alone, and by the end of this year, we think we will have expanded the lines of credit for businesses to the tune of $5 million. We also have a conduit financing program for significantly large financings. That's called the Industrial Development Bond Program. The state is not at risk with that. We act as a conduit of those loan proceeds, working with the company's traditional lender. They act as the manager of that money, and they step in and they're responsible. But it's not their capital that goes into it. It's the capital from a bond sale. We also have the Entrepreneurial Loan Development Fund. It's a capital access program for small businesses. Similarly, we have the Business Opportunities for Oregon Small Business Program, which will be starting here in a few days. That, too, provides working capital for small businesses. I just conclude with some of the contribution programs we have by referencing the Strategic Reserve Fund. That is our primary job retention and creation tool for the department. It provides awards that often go to support workforce training so we get people into jobs and capable and competent that helps them perform on their new duties. To date, we've approved awards that are projected to retain more than 3,200 jobs, and that those jobs will provide $13 million of income tax revenues from those salaries. And frankly, that's one of the things we're focusing on. We're a state agency that tries to create money for the state. When we do an analysis of an investment or a request that we receive, we look at how much are the wages going to be and what time period will that investment and contribution of that company be paid back to the state in terms of income taxes. Chandra mentioned the incentives report that we had. We are working on an incentive. One of the things that we saw in that report, one of the gaps that this state has, is it doesn't have a payroll-based incentive program. We have the incentives. Your committee has talked about them before. But when it comes to a business working on and getting something to help them make that payroll in the early years of that expansion, we don't have a program, and we're working on that. Another aspect, of course, that Chandra mentioned is the international trade. The state is very dependent upon that, and we have small stipends, for instance, that we provide a company to attend a foreign trade show and show their wares. One example of that was Cloud Cap Technology in Hood River, which is essentially an unmanned aircraft system. They participated in the Paris Air Show. We provided them $2,500 to attend that show, and their sales increased in 2009 by over $400,000 as a result of that visit, and we see that becoming a $2 million company very quickly just because of the contacts that they were able to make internationally. Chandra mentioned the innovation. That's certainly a part of what we try to make in connections between industry and research facilities. The research, the products of that research is useful certainly to transition businesses to the next generation of technology, but also the contribution the state makes to that organization leverages significant federal dollars. We've seen almost $200 million of federal research money come into our state universities as a result of the match that we can provide through that program. And the last thing that I want to point out is what we do for communities, trying to get them ready and receptive to businesses coming to their town. We have what's called an Infrastructure Finance Authority, which I act as the director of. We work with those communities to improve their water systems, their sewer systems, even their community facilities. You know, business comes to town, wants to know for their programs or for the people that are employed, well, there's going to be a community center available for them, and how will the community stack up versus other ones down the road, and having facilities that just make it a strong community. We have programs that finance that, and I will point out for you members who are always prominently thinking about labor and wages, all of those construction programs have prevailing wage as part of their package and obligation. With that, I'm, like Chandra, I'm anxious to hear from the following speakers of what they think we can do to better improve our business and our track of programs. So with that, if there aren't any questions, I'd be anxious to hear what they have to say.
Thank you. Yeah, you and Mr. McCabe and your folks are doing a good job, and I really appreciate what you all are doing down there at the Ironworks, and I'm pretty sure we're not going to drive a highway through your property. Am I right in that?
Thank you, sir. We greatly appreciate that.
I'm just one guy out of the crew here. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just ask a question.
Very good.
You mentioned a payroll-based system. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? And you said you're working on that. What that might look like and what it would achieve, and just share a little bit with us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we're still fleshing out the details, but essentially what we're looking at is a program that would provide an initial contribution to the company. And as I mentioned, the measurement would be how much in income tax will that employee that they hire be contributing to the state, and how fast would we recoup that investment from that individual. The challenge becomes, of course, tracking those individuals and their payroll and their income tax contribution. Those are part of the details we're working out right now. But it is based upon an incentive program that is paired to how much will they be contributing to income taxes in this state.
Well, if I may, so when we're doing those investments today, we're not making that analysis?
We are making that analysis, but the scale of what we have available to contribute is not as we would hope this program might be able to provide. We do that similar analysis with the strategic reserve, but generally those grants or those forgivable loans that we make to that company would be in the range of $100,000, maybe $200,000. And if an employer is going to come in and add 50 jobs and that payroll is going to contribute to income taxes over the next 2 years, $900,000, we have no program that can make that kind of contribution to that company.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think not getting access to natural resources, a incredibly growing restrictive land use process, a building permit process that's prohibitive, and a hostile environment for investment in the state probably isn't helping you very much. Anyway, with that, any representative?
Just had a slightly different question, I guess, about PR. I was disappointed to read in Executive Magazine last week. They moved our rating from 24th friendly towards business to 38th. What kind of impact does having that kind of, and it was, I guess, principally a response to Measure 66 and 67, what kind of impact does that have on our ability to recruit? And how widely distributed and respected is that magazine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, I'll certainly let Chandra respond from it.
Thank you.
Let me just say that.
Where's my gun?
Yeah. Throw me under the bus.
Yeah. No,
not yet. But I just want to say it's an opinion poll.
Okay.
Based upon perception. And to your point, mm-hmm. Yes, the perception of Oregon is not favorable as a result of that. But statistically, to counter that measure, and it was actually reported in that same news article on TV, an organization, research, independent research organization in Washington, D.C., who looks at states and their taxing on business. In spite of that report, still says that Oregon is in the top 14 states friendly to business.
Wow. How do we get that out?
Another press release.
Is that an opinion?
Yeah.
Well, but Chair Schaffler and Representative Kinnamura, I guess what I would add to that is I do think that we need to do a much better job overall in terms of PR and actually what Business Oregon is doing. If I still remember the days of Brand Oregon and what we were trying to do, which I thought was well done, could have been even better managed, but that was a program trying to get out the message that we are the global leader in, you know, green buildings, that we are the global leader in some of the renewable energy products, whether they be nuclear, whether they be wave, whether they be solar. And, you know, with such limited funding and resources, it's a question of, is that the best way we can use the state dollars, is to get this messaging out better? I mean, I think it's an excellent thing to do. It's just a question of where does that fall within the priorities and how can we do that better? Obviously, Brand Oregon didn't continue to be funded, so that was one program that I think did an excellent job trying to talk about what specifically are the strategic advantages of this state overall.
If people want to fund education, healthcare, and safety, they're going to help you, because that's where the money comes from. If people care about the environment in this world, they're going to come here and do their manufacturing, because we have the best, the highest, the most rigid labor, work safety, and environmental standards in the world. So if the people that work in this building care about their ecosystem, then they're going to help you manufacture things in Oregon. Our toilet paper does not come from Safeway. It comes from the forest. And everybody uses it. I won't get moving on. Any more questions for these good people? All right. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I look forward to meeting you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to
it. All right. I'm going to bring some nice people up. Get on my right list here. Okay. Jerry Smith, Tracy Liske, and John Zielinski. John, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing. And Terry Witt.
You were in it.
They're off.
You already talked to
us. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, God. Whoever wants to go first, guys.
Did you film the ball?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. With regards to your opening comments about not doing gross receipts tax, that takes care of that page.
They use some wood fiber to do that.
There you go.
I appreciate
it. I just want to make a couple comments, and I'll leave most of my time to those who are following, many of which are OFS members, people who actually do produce the farm and forest products that that we all rely upon. I just want to make two kind of overarching comments. Number one of the things that we're seeing happening as a result of increased cost to do business in Oregon is a collapse of the infrastructure that's necessary to support agriculture and forestry in Oregon. For example, fertilizer dealers, pest control products, dealers, distributors of farm equipment, those people who sell seed and process and dry seed. As you start collapsing the business structure in agriculture, you start collapsing the infrastructure that is needed to support that. That creates significant problems. Number one, it increases the cost to our farmers and foresters from a standpoint of having to transport material to and from their property longer distances, which obviously increases CO2 emissions. But it also makes them less competitive. And I think we all realize that both our farm and forest products in Oregon are mostly consumed outside of Oregon, not inside of Oregon. About 80% of our farm gate is exported out of the state of Oregon, not consumed within. And we have to be able to compete both internationally and globally, from the standpoint of North America and globally. So number one, that has a tremendous impact on cost of doing business in Oregon. Number two, I think we're also seeing, as we reduce the profitability of, let's just say, a family farm, what we do is we reduce the carrying capacity of that farm to support additional jobs. And we're seeing more and more next generation not coming back to the farm, but saying, my parents couldn't make a profitable living on this property. Why should I come back and farm this property? So they're leaving, and we are destroying some of the fabric of the agronomy base that we have here in the state of Oregon. We're seeing tremendous fund shifts taking place, fund sweeps taking place within the Department of Agriculture, which are taking fees that are paid by these farmers and foresters and chemical manufacturers, and they're being shifted for other purposes, which again decreases the benefit that is being should be given to these farmers and foresters, and using it for other alternatives. I do have one possible solution. I think every one of the 90 legislators ought to be given a yellow flag or a yellow hanky. In the NFL, there is a rule that when a runner, a ball carrier, is knocked to the ground, if people jump on top of him, that's called piling on, and you throw a flag. We need to stop the cost piling on from taking place in the legislature, and I would like everyone to carry a yellow flag, and whenever you see this piling on taking place for natural resource businesses in Oregon, I would hope people would start throwing yellow flags and saying, time out, this is a penalty. Sooner or later, you know, the burden is going to be so great that the running back is completely out of business, and that's what we don't want to have happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Who wants to go first?
Chair Soffler and members of the committee, I'm Jerry Simnett, owner of Simnett Nursery in Canby, and serve as the Oregon Association of Nurseries, the OAN's vice president, as well as the chair of the Government Relations Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a few remarks to the committee this morning on how the state and private sector may work together in creating jobs. The nursery and greenhouse industry remains the state's largest agricultural sector despite the severe economic downturn. Oregon nurseries ship their product throughout the country. In fact, over 80% of the nursery stock grown in our state goes out of state, with over half reaching markets east of the Mississippi River. Nursery Association members represent wholesale, Christmas tree growers, retailers, and greenhouse operations. And Mr. Chair, we could have a long conversation about any number of the following issues, challenges, or opportunities. But in an effort to be concise and respect the committee's time, I will give a brief overview of areas that impact the nursery and greenhouse industry. I think business and state government can work together. I think it's imperative that the business and state government find a positive way to interact and work together for the welfare of our state. Anything less is short-sighted and perpetuates a dysfunction that merely recognizes a political and economic pendulum. We can and we must do better. As an income tax state, it is essential that we get more people back to work. The state needs to recognize that they have every interest to promote job growth. It not only helps those who are underemployed or unemployed find work, it helps the bottom line of the state budget. To some degree, the state government needs to allow businesses to do what we do best, be innovative, seek market share, and bring much-needed dollars back to the state. I think my industry is a perfect example of this dynamic. We bring 80% of the dollars back from out of state into our state. And as policymakers, should examine ways to make this easier for us, not harder. For immigration reform, no other issue can cripple labor-intensive industries as anti-immigration laws. It should not be a mystery to you that the OAN has a high profile in this controversial issue, and I respectfully request that you do not follow the path of Arizona. The business community, through the Coalition for a Working Oregon, continues its strong advocacy of comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level. It is a federal issue, plain and simple. Legislators need to recognize the economic wreckage it could create by giving in to the emotional side of the frustrations over a lack of true immigration reform. There's several key policies that I think we should be considered to aid in economic growth and transportation, water, and green infrastructure. There is no greater impact the state can make with businesses than more smart infrastructure investments that pay economic dividends to future generations. We applaud the bipartisan legislation passed in 2009 on a transportation package that will help nursery operations ship to the market. However, the nursery and greenhouse industry needs to become more multimodal, and this includes much-needed investment in reliable rail transportation. We are working with our congressional delegation to seek greater federal dollars, and Oregon needs to be in a position to tap into this federal investment cost-sharing to increase frequency and reliability of this mode of transportation. This investment will assist Oregon industries in an effort to remain competitive in key markets and create a cornerstone for economic growth. The nursery and greenhouse industry is water-dependent, and it is essential that the state work hard to resolve urban-rural conflicts and promote water efficiency and not shy away from below- and above-ground storage opportunities. House Bill 3369, passed in 2009, had promised to begin the hard discussion of water allocation, environmental balance, and the acknowledgement that storage of water is in our long-term economic interest. We commit to work with traditional and non-traditional allies to resolve an issue that will make land use conflicts seem small in comparison. We cannot avoid this fight. The question remains if we can work together to avoid choosing one industry over another. We also applaud the state in their effort to look at growing green technologies and economic benefit it could create in Oregon. It is important that we continue to diversify our economic base. I would urge, however, that you do not forget the green industries that are already here. There are numerous examples of green infrastructure, effective role in environmental offsets and transportation projects, stormwater management, climate change mitigation, and improvement of water and air quality. Trees and other plantings can be part of this green infrastructure plan that not only will bolster economic activity and job creation within the nursery industry, but support suppliers, transportation, and commercial operations throughout the state. For energy policy, I think it should promote efficiency and supply. The stability of cost and supply of energy is a big issue for the nursery and greenhouse industry. We see an ample role of the state to promote greater incentives towards energy-intensive industries to become more efficient and work on energy supply options for future needs. This will not only create jobs and innovation in the energy arena, but provide an ancillary benefit to expansion and increased job creation by existing industries. I think it's also important to remember the regulatory and cost environment that takes into consideration the cumulative effect of small business. It is important for legislators to fully understand the hardship business owners go through to make ends meet. Cimic Nursery, our nursery, will be fortunate if we retain the same revenue as we did last year. Now, mind you, revenue does not equate to profits. We work hard to employ hardworking individuals, provide product that has an environmental and economic benefit to the state, and promote an environment where fees and regulations seem to increase without serious evaluation of its cumulative impact on our business. We are in no way suggesting that Oregonians and businesses not pay for the government we want or need. We would just suggest that you take a long, hard look at the impacts of yearly increases in fees and regulations have on businesses and make sure it is not corrosive to job creation. In conclusion, I am very proud of my industry's ability to provide economic strength to Oregon. We are the green industry due to our ability to export clean air through trees, increase livability at homes in states across the country, supply products through their use that have a tangible impact on the reduction of heat island effects, energy used by commercial businesses, and provide a much-needed environmental benefit on our roads and in our neighborhoods. We stand ready to work with our governmental partners to create healthy economy, a sustainable set of industries, and do what Oregon does best, innovate, create opportunity for all workers. Thank you very much for your time.
Chair, representatives, my name is Tracy Liskey. I'm my family farm in the Klamath Falls area. My brother, sister, and I are fourth generation farmers in the Klamath Basin. I'm also first vice president of Oregon Farm Bureau. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about investing in jobs in Oregon agriculture. Ag is Oregon's second largest economic sector. There are about 37,000 Oregon farm families who employ 30,000 workers on a non-harvest permanent run, up to 100,000 workers during the peak seasons, on an average of 58,000 jobs to the state of Oregon. On an average, these employees make over $11 an hour. Some of the piece rate make over $20 an hour. I'm telling you this to reaffirm the importance of agriculture to the state for revenue and for employment. Ag is a business. Like other businesses, agriculture relies on balanced regulatory oversight and investments in infrastructure like water and transportation. But unlike many businesses, ag is 99% family-owned, and we are out there working 7 days a week to make it work. We, the businessmen and women of agriculture, need the state to invest in our traditional services like extension service, ag experiment stations, forest research labs, Department of Ag, and Water Resource Department. In the last two bienniums, we have seen the state's investments in natural resource services decrease by over 17%. Other regulatory burdens have made many of our value-added partnerships leave the state, such as food processing, meat packing, and so on. One of the most pressing economic opportunities the state can make for ag is to invest in water. As I have said, my operation is in the Klamath Falls area, and being from that area, I understand the effects of government regulation. Due to Mother Nature giving her waters to other areas, super high river flows due to court mandates, low inflows with high lake levels due to Endangered Species Act, our irrigation season is restricted again this year. Not just the Klamath, but the statewide Oregon needs to invest in water development for agriculture and for its growing populations. This would include implementation of conservation, reuse, and storage projects, emphasizing storage projects. Since the majority of Oregon's water falls in the winter, we need to make sure that it's available year-round. Without water, there's no ag. As the state looks at infrastructure, I agree that environmental protection are important. But new regulations can add significant cost to a project. We have to find a balance. Under HB 3369, passed in 2009, it places high regulatory standards on projects utilizing state funds. These regulations make projects more complex and expensive and discourage current Oregon projects from partnering with the state. One example, a group of farmers just outside of Salem formed an irrigation district over 20 years ago to address limiting water, groundwater. They have done environmental assessments on three sites and have spent over $500,000 and are probably $500,000 away from even breaking ground. These environmental assessments are one of the largest challenges farmers and other water users face in moving a project forward. Once done, the bonding and leverage of federal funds becomes possible. On our ranch, we have been able to take what is once seen as a liability of 199-degree water and make it into an asset. Through geothermal, we are using natural hot water to heat greenhouses, generate biodiesel, raise fish, and are working on producing power. We have utilized business energy credits and federal money to develop some of these projects. As I said earlier, ag is the second largest economic sector, but with higher regulations and higher costs, the next generation is not staying in ag. Ag is a business that's already here, and we need to make sure it stays here. It'll be cheaper to keep it here than bring another business in. And what is more sustainable than third, fourth generation farmers and more green than what we are today? So I hope you can help us do that.
Thank you. And my top issue with green is I want more green in the workers' pockets in Oregon. That's my number one priority. If you go up my office, you can see an aerial photo of the dairy farm. My father grew up in Minnesota. My uncle and my cousins still operate that farm. It's not a dairy anymore. That one and the one right down the road. I grew up in Iowa, where they produced an award-winning pig in Portland cook-off. I don't know if you read about that in the paper or not, but it's a pretty funny story. But God bless Oregon pork producers. But I got to tell you, I grew up working on farms, bucking hay, shoveling manure. I worked my second year in college at night in a packing plant. Agriculture has been very good to me. Obviously, I enjoy eating. And our food doesn't come from Safeway. It comes from here. And you know, you good people and everyone else on this list, I want as many pro-ag business timber concepts you can possibly come up with for next session, and I'm going to shamelessly challenge anybody in this building to vote against them. So, and agriculture is green, it is sustainable, so is timber. Being against timber is like being against corn and pork in Iowa. It's absurd to be against timber in this state, and we need to do everything we can to develop as much water as we humanly can in this state.
Representative Cameron, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you, gentlemen, for being here and testifying today. And Tracy, you gave one specific. You mentioned House Bill 3369, and I had just passed a note to Chair during the testimony saying we need specifics. And I really appreciate your industries and the agricultural, but that's exactly what I know the 10 people up here, I'm not going to speak for all 10 of us, but I know that most of us want to hear exactly what those regulations are that has been not yellow flagged, that continue to pile up. We need the specifics. So this goes to anybody here testifying today, if you've got specific ORSs or House bills that have been passed that you say this is what we need to shed to make a difference in Oregon, we would really like that list. You can email it to my office. I'm sure the chair would want to see that as well. So thank you for your testimony and getting into specifics. And if you've got some more, we'd love to hear them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, one specific, just to give you an indication of some of the things that are on the horizon. The State Fire Marshal's Office oversees the Community Right to Know program. They are currently looking at raising a fee that will be placed on our dealers and distributors of fertilizers. Currently, they're assessed a $25 registration fee. If they change the class of fertilizer from a registration fee to a hazard class 1, that will raise their fee from $25 per year to $9,000 per year. Those are the kind of things that are not just one man piling on, but the whole team jumping on the back.
Is that by rule?
Yes.
Well, remind me of that in January. Are you finished, Representative?
No, it's exactly. In an email or even come and visit and give us those specifics, and I know we want to know about those things.
Unbelievable. Representative Kenner, then Representative Esquivel, please.
Thank you.
I know that one of your issues, as you mentioned, is water. And it's interesting, in a partly rural and suburban county like Clackamas, from which I hail, the county commissioners are in earnest looking at some pretty restrictive work on water. And I wondered how prevalent is that idea of trying to regulate it at the state level, and at the county levels, and wondered about your opinion on that.
You know, in Klamath, our county is very pro water storage in that order, but it's still, you know, we have to deal with the federal issue because of the reclamation project in that order, and we've had storage projects on since, you know, my dad was working on it when he was a kid and trying to get these projects going, and they're good storage projects. And, you know, they not only benefit agriculture, but they benefit wildlife, water, and the fish. And these projects, you just get so frustrated because they study and they study and they study, and we never get anything done. And that's, you know, and kind of back to the representative's question, you get into these projects of nothing ever being done, and the next generation of my farm is not coming back. We've went from over 50 employees, and we're down to about 4 right now, and probably by the end of the year, we'll be down to 1. Just because of regulations down to, you know, you get more wages all the time thrown on you, that our business can't handle. And we're getting up to the age of, we're looking at doing other things. I mean, instead of investing in Oregon, we're moving back. And that's not how we've been. A very proactive farm and a very proactive ranch in trying to develop things as in agriculture, geothermal parks, and those kind of things that make things work. But this state and the whole country is just regulates you out of the world, and they don't ever seem to fix anything. They just, you know, back to you in the story, we have answers and stuff, but nothing ever happens, and it gets real frustrating from a point of work. And I don't have the time to be here or be fighting the regulations, because I'm on that ranch 7 days at working. You know, I was under a pipe welding last night till 3 or 4 o'clock, so I could drive here to be here today just to get things done. And it is frustrating, and I hope, you know, with good common sense, we can move forward and kind of change that line so the state can move forward.
We're processed, analyzed, consulted, regulated to death.
Mm-hmm.
Representative, quick follow-up.
I wanted to comment. I appreciate your comment about the disconnect between your local and your state. And I guess what worries me is I see some new disconnects at the local and state level that I think are very troublesome.
The problem is the elitist Chardonnay crowd's belly's full, and they're driving the ship. Representative Esquivel.
Very briefly, I observe in the Klamath area the outcome of the election due to the dam removal positions of the various candidates. Is that, in fact, going to have a detrimental effect to agriculture in the area?
Right. The dam removal? Dam removal has no water storage. There would be a power lossage to it. Some of the Siskiyou County in California has a revenue factor that'll be a loss. But, you know, I'm against dam removal. I'm against all that. But I do support KBRA, which is the agreement, because it tries to get an answer that we seem to never get an answer to. At least we're trying to do something to fix the problem. And there are a lot out there that are stuck on, I'm against the dam, removing this dam. And no matter whether the consequences are that another 260,000 acres of agriculture doesn't get irrigated in the future, you know, we're going to be stuck on this one issue. So, you know, it's a personal issue, but somewhere in the line we have to find the answer to our problem down there, either in story, working together, trying to improve the fish runs, and go on forward.
You know, I'd love to sit and listen to you all day because you're preaching to the choir here. But I got to move on. I'm sorry. I really appreciate everything you're doing, though. I really do. And you know what? We're energy dependent on a bunch of people that don't like us, and I don't want to be food dependent on a bunch of people that don't like us. So I'm with you. I appreciate you coming.
Getting that
today,
way,
folks.
Though.
And if anybody has prepared testimony, can you email it to Ms. Van Winkle so we can get it to everybody up here? All right, Mr. Zielinski, come on up. And let's keep our testimony brief, folks. We really got a lot to cover here today, and I'll try and keep my mouth shut, and I ask my colleagues to do the same. Good luck on that, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
We'll do it if you will, Mr. Chair.
I got to lead by example. I use toilet paper. Go ahead, sir.
Glad to hear you. Good morning, representatives. My name is John Zielinski, and I farm and operate Easy Orchards, a farm direct and wholesale operation just northeast of Salem here. I farm with my brothers. My father's retired. I'm a fifth-generation farmer in the area. We settled on that same land in the 1870s. Oregon agriculture is vital and vastly... I'm sorry, let me start over here. Oregon agriculture is vast in its diversity. We raise over 220 crops, and almost every farmer's operation is unique. While my family has taken advantage of local markets, not every farm is situated to take advantage of the rural-urban interface. 80% of the crops raised in Oregon are exported out of the state, and of that, 50% goes overseas. These exports are important to Oregon, and also to producers like me. Oregonians could never come close to consuming all the apples and other crops that we raise within the state. In fact, on our farm, because of consolidation and the large grocers only buying from large packing houses, we no longer sell to some of the major grocery chains. We ship our apples to Yakima, where they're packed by a mega warehouse, and then shipped back to Oregon to the chain stores.
That's amazing.
Maintaining a transportation infrastructure that aids in the moving of ag products through and out of the state is critical for agriculture and other industries. This includes roads and ports. Unfortunately, new plans from ODOT designed to help make the roads more efficient have actually made it more difficult. They're talking about closing access roads that have low traffic to the highways. These access roads are important for moving farm products to market. Rural economic development is a critical need in Oregon. First and foremost, Oregon needs to support and expand our existing businesses. Next, we need to strategically recruit new businesses that will complement existing operations. The loss of food processing is a concern to Oregon farmers. The value-added opportunities that they bring to farms, crops, is important. And just a couple of key elements that I wanted to touch on is that from farm to your fork, Oregon agriculture employs 214,000 skilled workers statewide, making labor our number one expense. Also, very important to agriculture, because agriculture is not stagnant. People might think and look out across a grass seed field or a wheat field and think, oh, same thing was growing there last year. What's new? But there are new things. An investment in OSU, Extension Services, Ag Experiment Stations, Forest Research Lab, the Department of Agriculture, Water Resources are important. And unfortunately, for the last two biennium, these have been cut by nearly 17%. Investment is important in these state resources because agriculture is changing, and there is always new development, new varieties of wheat, new varieties of apples, chemical testing, what will grow here in Oregon, what won't grow, what new crops are available to add to that list of 220 crops. So those are some of the things that are important to me. And I know as I was walking through the rotunda there and I looked up at the murals and saw murals of lumbermen and farmers, you know, they show them in that nice 1930s WPA style with strong backs. And I truly believe that America was built on small business, and farmers are the first small businesses that were here. 151 years ago, small business was about 95% farmers and timbermen here in Oregon. If we overregulate, overtax our farms and small businesses, those strong backs are going to break. We'll wake up one morning and have a severe backache, and that's not a good thing for the economy.
I get a headache thinking about it. You know, farmers are the most independent, self-sufficient, innovative, sustainable people in the world, and that mindset's taken us right into the Industrial Revolution.
You also left out Henri, but
hey, well, God bless every one of you. You'll never see that up here. Any questions to this fine farmer here? All right. I really appreciate you coming and taking your time off from work today.
Thank you.
So thank you. All right. Mike Salzgiver and Charlie Alec, please. What are we doing on time? Mike, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am Mike Salzgiver. I serve as Executive Director of the Oregon Columbia Chapter of Associated General Contractors. Our chapter headquarters are located in Wilsonville, Oregon, and we represent 1,100 commercial contractors, specialty contractors, and industry professionals and associates. Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for inviting us to join the committee today. You asked us to do three things, and I will do that. I'm not going to read this testimony that's getting handed out to you. Some of it I will, some of it I'll jump through, some of it I'll summarize, and some of it I'll ad lib. First, the other thing I want to do is thank you for your comments this morning. I think it got people thinking, and it certainly woke me up, so I appreciate that.
I hope you're being represented well in the building today.
I am, and you are my representative, so thank you for that. Made me wonder what was in the water out there. I got to drink some more.
Well, it probably ain't fluoride.
Thank God.
What I would like to do, Mr. Chairman and members, is give you some basics about the industry, because one of the things I've learned in the 2 years I've been in this job is people still don't understand what AGC is and what contractors are. I want to talk about some of the economic conditions that we're facing, which are very draconian and very real, and then offer some thoughts, as Representative Cameron suggested, and that you have asked, about some of the actions that government can take to support the generation of jobs in our industry so that we can get ourselves back to work. First thing to keep in mind is that Oregon, construction in Oregon is primarily a small business industry. 94% of the businesses in construction in this state employ fewer than 20 workers. 86% employ fewer than 10, and 75% employ fewer than 5. The average gross revenue in those companies is less than $2 million a year. And that doesn't mean they earn $2 million a year, as many people think. That's what they take in before they pay the bill, and they keep a lot less of that. Our membership represents companies that total over 33,000 employees. And in Oregon, that's actually only a tenth, though, of the employee base of the construction base in Oregon, which is was at its peak over 300,000 men and women. Listening to the folks that preceded me on the panel this morning, and then looking at the witness list, it jumped out at me that much of what this hearing is about this morning is being back to basics. You're talking about agriculture, the basic industries of Oregon, agriculture and timber, construction, fisheries, ports, the utilities. Those are the basic industries that built this state. And it's easy to get caught up in the new thing of the moment. But ultimately, what's going to get us out of this recession, and for my industry, it's a depression. And I don't use that word lightly. It's going to be getting back to basics. So it's important from that standpoint to understand where construction fits in the economic cycle. Depending on where you start, we are second or third largest sector in the state's economy. At our peak in December of 2007, we employed over 110,000 people in construction. From 2004 through 2007, as we were coming out of the popping of the tech bubble, which I participated in, I might add, construction basically fueled Oregon's growth. Even today, our average annual wage in this industry is over $46,000 a year, which is a pretty good living wage, and it's about $5,500 per year above the statewide average of just over $40,000. Construction is a job multiplier. For every $10 million spent on construction, there are 70 new construction industry jobs created, and for every $10 million spent, there are 160 total jobs created. So we have an inducing and a multiplying effect there. I mentioned just a bit ago that we are in a depression. Since December of 2007, we have lost 37,000 jobs. That's 1,276 jobs lost every month for 29 months. And if you take the average wage, break it out by monthly wage, multiply it times the months that we have been in this depression, the state, my industry alone, has lost just a little over $4 billion in income. That's why we are involved in this process and why we are here this morning. When you talk about gross receipts or gross revenues, I'm not going to talk at your direction about an earlier discussion, but gross revenues in my industry are down between 30 and 90%. The gentleman that was just here from Klamath County, I was just in Klamath on Thursday and Friday. Business volumes down there are down an astonishing 60 to 90% in construction. There are companies that had 110 employees 2 years ago that are down to 5. And they're trying to figure out how to keep the doors open. So, in short, this industry is in a recession. It is deep, it is wide, and there are indications that without something breaking soon, we're going to be in this at least through 2013, if not longer. That's what our economists and industry analysts are telling us. Today, most of the work in construction is coming from public work. There's virtually no private work going on in construction at all, except small tenant improvement projects or other things. A lot of that is due to the financial crisis that hit in September of 2008, and privately funded projects have basically all but evaporated because banks are being required by regulators to impose terms that owners and the companies are unable or unwilling to accept. So the motto that I have adopted as I continue to look forward is a variation on the Hippocratic Oath, which is do no further harm. As an association, we have been focused over the last 18 months on a public policy agenda that slows or stops the job losses, that stabilizes our industry, and sets the stage for future growth. That's why we thank the legislature for passing a new transportation bill. It was our top 2009 priority, and we want to thank those of you who were able to vote for it. It's a bill that is critical to Oregon's long-term economic interests in nearly every respect, and frankly, right now, for about a third of my members, it's the only work they have, as we're starting to see those projects plus stimulus projects come online. And it's the other reason. It's another reason why AGC continues to defend this bill, as those who disagree with it try to overturn it through the initiative process. I handed out to you a report that was published in late 2008 by AGC of America. All of you have a copy of it. It's primarily a federal report. But I want to talk about it from the standpoint of what it offers in the way of a blueprint, perhaps, for Oregon. It's heavily federal, and as you read through it, you'll see a lot of federal suggestions, particularly on the tax side. But what it suggests is that through a combination of public works projects and tax regulation and tax policy changes and other regulatory changes, there is a path for the construction industry out of this. And so I would encourage you to look at that. On page 8, I want to point out three things. Establishing an infrastructure bank. Mr. Schessler talked about using the state's business development funds for leveraging of government dollars to stimulate private activity. That is something that the state could look at, public-private partnerships. The other thing I want to talk about is streamlining government, because it is important to remember that as you look at, or the state continues to impose new regulations, that has a direct impact on our ability to do our business. The other thing I want to talk about as far as investments are concerned is workforce development. In the next 10 years, you're going to see about half of our workforce retire and leave the workforce, and that's why our industry, our chapter, in fact, is spending 20% of our operating budget on workforce development programs, and we need your help in doing that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will close and be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the good work you're doing, and it's a kind of a sad report. Public works are not sustainable unless we have a private sector. We're pretty cavalier in the state, running off jobs in this state, billions of dollars of investment. And, you know, I've never seen an anti-construction activist whose belly wasn't full. You know, they're pretty cavalier. Any questions of Representative Kennedy?
Thank you. I guess I'll make this more in the point of a comment than a question. I don't need to put you in the middle of something, but I think I appreciated your comments about the public works programs. They are putting some people to work, but they're not being as productive as most of us would like. And I think last time we had a proposal called Main Street that would have put an enormous number of people back on the jobs rolls, and I guess I do want to remind people of that, and I think we ought to look at that next time, since what we've been doing isn't working, and I think the old axiom of it's not working, you maybe need to do something different. So,
and you know, the solution ain't on Wall Street or Pennsylvania Avenue, it's right here on Court Street. That's where we're going to solve our problems. Any more questions of this good gentleman?
One thing.
Representative.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been brought up here about environmental situations, and I want to share with you that we had a south interchange that we spent, I believe, $3.5 million in 2 years on an environmental impact statement to state, yes, this is where we need to put the interchange, even though it was existing.
On a happier note, we do have some programmatic permitting processes that ODOT's implemented to make that a little better. So there are some good things to talk about.
Well, and to that point, Mr. Chairman, if I could, before I leave, in my testimony I referred to something called the Earth, the Economic Revitalization Team. I don't want it to be misunderstood that I'm up here, my members would kill me if they thought I was up here talking about enhancing bureaucracy, but one of the good things that's happened out of the last decade has been the creation of the Earth, which is a coordinating team of 10 state agencies that are focused on job creation, job retention, and economic activity and development, and that group actually works relatively well. I was a part of it for 3 years, and I can tell you that going forward, as we look at imposing new regulations or as we look at other activities that the state will be involved in, that group can be essential in helping us cut through some of the problems that we will face.
All right. Mike, I really appreciate you coming down today. Is Charlie Alcock here? Charlie, you out there? All right, we're moving on then. Vicky Handy, Ray Hoyt, and Steve Puste. I hope I'm saying that wrong. All right.
Yes, I'll come down to you.
Whoever wants to go first, go ahead. You're going to need my hammer there for a minute.
Well, we can probably use it. I want to thank you for allowing us to represent the trucking industry today. I'd like to introduce our panel. I'm Vicki Handy. I'm the chair of the Trucking Solutions Consortium, and I'm joined by Steve Puste, who's a senior VP of Operations for Food Services of America, and Ray Hoyt, who's the director of customized training for Clackamas Community College. What we're going to be going through today is good news. I've been hearing a lot of bad news. We have some good news. Trucking is maybe a little bit better shape. What I want to do is go through a little bit of introduction around our consortium. I'm going to talk a little bit about the industry projections. I want to talk a little bit about our current efforts, what we're trying to do to make this better, and then end with what we need from you. First, I'd like to introduce you to our consortium. This is a more of an organic group. It's not a political action committee at all. It's really a collaborative partnership between industry, education, and WorkSource Oregon. We have 9 community colleges engaged in our consortium. We have about 100 trucking companies, and we have Higher Oregon Vets and many other agencies involved in getting drivers into companies. Our focus is really around business improvement and trying to improve how we operate trucking companies so that we can retain our employees. Through that, we do best practices, training, recruitment efforts, and communications. Our focus is really around problem solving. Internally, what can we do as a group to make it different? This is a unique partnership. It's the only program like it in the United States serving the trucking industry, because we are specifically designed to get drivers into our industry. Our consortium started about 5-6 years ago in Clackamas County with Clackamas Community College, Oregon Trucking Association, IITR, and many of the companies in Clackamas County. What we've been able to do is build an effective infrastructure for bringing training to trucking companies and bring trucking companies together to solve their own problems. Since then, we not only have our what we call our Northwest Hub in Clackamas County that really tries to leverage statewide large-scale efforts, but we also have regional consortia that focus on local needs and partnering with their local community colleges. Through this, we've been able to provide an infrastructure for statewide deployment of training and problem solving. Our goals are pretty simple and straightforward. Bottom line, we want to professionalize the industry. Nobody wants to work for somebody who doesn't treat them right, and we want to make sure that it's a good place to work. The last 18 months, our focus has really been shifted and it's evolved to helping our businesses be more profitable. We've done that by transitioning our training to more business-oriented training to bring in more sophisticated models and tools. Three and four, we want to hire and develop drivers. That's really the focus of our efforts. We do believe in standardized training. We've been able to do that well. We have developed visible career paths, and our focus is to support green technology and bring it to the trucking companies. I'd like to talk a little bit about the specific issues around truck driver shortage. I know it sounds crazy. We've lost jobs. I mean, that's all you've been hearing. Well, our industry has suffered historically from a shortage for truck drivers, and we anticipate that coming back and being even worse as we move into the 2011. 72% of all freight in Oregon is moved by trucks. ODOT anticipates that doubling in volume. 2007, before our recession, there was estimated a shortage of 20,000 drivers across the United States, and that is predicted to reach over 100,000. All of the analysts are sticking to that for a number of reasons. Even though the pressure over the last 18 months hasn't been as strong, we're hiring. We still need drivers. In a trucking survey that we sent out to almost 800 companies, recruiting and training our new truck drivers was identified as their key obstacle for profitability. And I think a very important piece here is trucking is the cluster that serves all clusters. If you got it, a truck brought it. And if there's a problem with trucking, it's going to affect every single cluster in the state of Oregon. So hopefully that brings a little bit of attention to us. There's one other piece that is a serious compounding issue, and that is our replacement openings with the trucking's aging workforce. If you take a look at these statistics, you can see we're going to be replacing about half of the drivers in our state. And we're doing that with very low population in our feeder pools in our labor market. We have to do some efforts right now to bring people into the industry. I want to mention truck driving as an occupation. Right now, there's over 108,000 people employed in truck driving roles in the state of Oregon. It is a high-wage job. We have clear career paths. And in the last 18 months, in our worst economic times, we have had 745 new professional truck drivers with their CDL graduation. And out of those, 623 were hired into new jobs and have been sustained in those new jobs. We not only track the placement rate, we track the retention rate. We're showing a good track record here, and I hope that that brings some attention to our focus today. I'd like to introduce Steve Puste. Steve has been a member of our consortium from the very beginning. Steve and his folks have been involved in everything that we've done. They've participated in our training, in our job fairs, and his folks have been key subject matter experts as we have developed curriculum that targets the trucking industry. Steve?
Thank you, and good morning. My involvement with the consortium was for the need for drivers. And I've been in the business for over 30 years, and for the past 10 years, I've noticed working for a lot of large and small trucking companies, that the driver pool has been shrinking. And the question always was brought to me by senior management and by the owners of those companies, what are you going to do about it? And there was no clear-cut answer, and I needed to get some help. So what we did is we pulled together the companies in the area and found that they all had the same problems. And we had gone to Clackamas Community College to go to the educators to see what kind of help we could get in training. And from that, we've been able to develop some programs. In 2007, we wound up not being able to get any drivers at all. We could not find a driver that had experience and wanted to come work for our company. And we were growing. And that went on to about the middle of 2008. And in end of 2008, in the food service companies, wound up having a shrinkage because of the economy. Restaurants were closing. There was less people eating out. And consequently, we had layoffs, and we didn't need to hire. So if we look back over the next couple of years, for the next 5 years, we're going to be needing to replace 14 drivers that are going to be retiring. And the average age of our drivers is 43 years of age. The following 5 years, there's going to be another 14 drivers, so a total of 28 drivers. And right now, we can't find drivers to even to grow a business. And basically what happens is we don't have enough drivers. All the drivers that work for us have to work an extra day. So they might be working, instead of a four-day work week, they work a five-day work week. Instead of a five-day work week, they work a six-day work week. And then if we don't have enough drivers to do that, then supervisors go out and make deliveries. So there's a real demand here for not only the replacement drivers that we have in the aging workforce, but also because our business is going to be increasing over the next couple of years. Just to give you an example, in 2007 we couldn't hire any drivers. At the end of 2008 we didn't need any through 2009. In 2010, this year in February, we decided to have a job fair because we were going to hire some drivers.
I don't want the lights.
Okay.
And when we put that job fair together, we had 30 applicants, which was great. Out of those 30 applicants, there was only three that we saw was qualified to even be interviewed. And after we interviewed those three, we hired none of them. And that was because of either bad driving records, because of accidents, not enough experience, where they just was not a fit for the organization. They might have been able to drive a truck, but were they a service driver? Were they be able to interact with our customers? So that's where we're looking for help in programs that can help develop and train drivers to fit into the growing demands of these companies.
Thanks, Steve. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the current efforts we're doing for trucking companies before I ask for your help and what you can do for trucking companies. I'd like to start with a short clip that we have. It's only 30 seconds out of a 8-minute recruitment video that we put together, DVD, for all of our companies. Oops. Or not. I'm glad it's only 30 seconds.
Do you need more of this?
Email this stuff out, and sometimes it doesn't all transfer correctly. That's okay.
Well, that was informative.
It was so informative. That's okay.
You're doing great.
Yeah, if any of you are interested, we can get you a copy of either the short clip or the full 8-minute DVD. It's an example of one of the things we're doing for our recruitment efforts. We have put together our DVD. We work with Hire Oregon Vets. We work with WorkSource Oregon in all of our regions. We now do joint job fairs. We do this collaboratively where we literally take over an entire job fair with a half dozen, six, seven, eight different companies, including the training and all of the ways you can get into the trucking industry. Again, we call that our leveraged job fair effort, and we make it a real focus point. We also provide best practices for our trucking companies. We've done quite a bit around green technology, bringing that technology into companies that may not be aware of it. We've done an awful lot this year around human resource systems. Again, if it's not a company a person wants to work with, they're not going to stay. So we've been really trying to influence companies with that. And our next focus is really around technology for fuel management. We've also been very skilled at providing management training, lean methodology, leadership, and we have an entire program around school age involvement. Again, we want to shift the community perception of trucking to get more people into our industry. These are some of the things we're doing. The other very, I think, critical piece that we have, again, a rather unique piece to the industry, is we have developed a professional truck driver statewide certificate through the community colleges. This was a program spearheaded by Clackamas Community College. We were able to develop a four-course program that is accredited for 19 college credits. This program is now used, it's been adopted by every single truck driving school in the state, so that we have standardized training that brings the skill level higher than a CDL, commercial driver license. We have developed the infrastructure for the delivery of this, and really this has increased the readiness to work so that we don't have zero hires, and it exceeds all of the ODOT and federal requirements. Again, this is a unique program, unique to our state, and it's getting quite a bit of attention externally. This was the team that put it together in the first place. I'd like to introduce Ray Hoyt, who is with Clackamas Community College, one of our primary partners in this endeavor, and he's going to talk a little bit about community college role.
Great. Thank you, Chairman and representatives. This is a great opportunity being here this morning. We serve employers in industry. That's a lot of what community colleges do. And our role in customized training is to work closely with industry partners and a host of other partners too, including the truck driver, in this situation, the truck driver training companies, WorkSource Clackamas, which includes the Workforce Investment Board, Workforce Investment Act people, and the Oregon Employment Department, especially, State of Oregon, Oregon Economic Community Development Department, at least that's what it used to be called, and I keep forgetting what it's called now, but there we go. Clackamas Community College, certainly we're actively involved with this, as well as K-12, which is a unique situation, I might add. Driving this stuff into kindergarten is really kind of a fun thing. The whole image thing about truck driver is changing as we've marched into this program, which is pretty special. But this is a unique program. It's been state approved. It's been vetted out. Made it through the entire adverse impact process, due to help from both industry, truck driver training companies, as well as consortium members. Active community colleges right now include Clatsop, Blue Mountain, Umpqua. These are the ones who are delivering the training. Southwestern, Rogue, Central Oregon Community College. We're assisting with that a little bit through Clackamas. Treasure Valley, Lane, Klamath Falls. They're a member of the organization. And certainly Clackamas Community College. So we've been around the system long enough. We've been able to vet this thing out, and it's going well. Each region is different, and we have to customize it a bit. However, the standard to this is that all the trainers are standard. They've been through a week-long training. Mentors have been trained. The curriculum is identical. So the industry gets a standard. We think that's really critical. That's pretty unique, actually. The next slide, this led to, just as I was arriving on the scene at Clackamas, I'd spent 20 some odd years in the system, but I just had arrived at Clackamas, and my first meeting was down here in Salem, actually, as some money was coming forward through the legislature, through the Oregon, through the OECDD, to create a loan scholarship program. And over the course of 2 years, our goal is to train up 50 workers using those funds. And we exceeded that. We actually trained 67 people, and it was really pretty neat. All the community colleges have voted support of this continuation of this kind of program, but there's some great stories. One story that comes to mind is of some people who are struggling. If you look at their text, or rather their credit scores, you think, not even their score, but just their recent history. They've lost a home or nearly lost a home. Both of them have lost their jobs. And so they were able to access these funds, and what happened was is that they went through the training. They had 50% loan, 50% scholarship. They went through the training, got hired, the company paid the bill. They paid off the loan. And that's what's happened in a number of these situations because industry really values the people that have come through this program. And we're ready to ramp up further and go statewide. This is a beta test, if you will, in the greater Clackamas County area. You know, we've got the structures in place and the format in place and the guidelines and the process flow in place. And that took a little doing because we're talking about multiple agencies here. But we worked it out, and with industry's assistance, we've pulled it off, and we're ready to take it to the next level if that's, that's the way it ends up going.
Great. Bottom line, our biggest barrier is the need for qualified drivers with commercial driver's license. We want workers. We're not talking about the layoffs. We want more. Our solution, we need to continue our tuition funds for training the professional truck drivers, getting them their certificate, getting them their CDL, and getting them into the labor pool so we are not impacting 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line that is going to impact not only trucking but all of the clusters that trucking serves. The other thing that we want is to continue our consortium work with some operating capital. We have been able to successfully build an infrastructure for statewide deployment, an infrastructure for connecting all trucking companies. And the focus here is to make it a better place to work and bring in good drivers and give them a long-term career with a good job. That's what we're about, and we'd like to have your support and help making that happen. In the materials that you have a little piece on our consortium, you have our PowerPoint, and you have our truck driver tuition training program. Are there any questions or comments?
I just want to thank you for coming, first of all. I referred to my old man earlier. After he got out of the Army, he went and got a job in town, and he got a job loading trucks. Then he went to a trade school for a year and became a dispatcher. Then he became a traffic manager. Then he ran a truck line, and then when he got old, he brokered loads out of his house on the phone.
Well, then you
so
know the career path.
Trucking was very much a part of my youth. And I want to thank you and the Oregon Trucking Association. Mike Salzgrib earlier referred to the transportation package. That's how a tax package should be put together in this state. It was negotiated for years. It had incredibly broad base support. And that's how we should build our revenue system in this state. I really want to thank you for supporting that. I also, in my other duties, I'm on the advisory committee for the Center for Research on Occupational Environmental Toxicology at OHSU. That's a mouthful. And they're currently doing some studies on the environment of truck drivers because they're out there alone. It's really, I never thought of it that way. But, and then my question to you, looking for skilled drivers, I would hope you reach out to my union brothers and sisters out at the Teamsters Union if you want to find some skilled drivers. How do you work with those good people?
Absolutely.
God bless you.
And a number of our, aren't you Teamsters?
Yes.
Good. All right. So. Representative Cameron.
Well, first, another editorial comment. Part of the reason I got through college is I was a Teamster working for Canada Dry and made about double what most of my peers were making in those days, which is the question, I guess. So what kind of wages and benefits typically are these drivers getting?
In our state, the average wage, I believe, is $18.54. In the metro area, it's close to $20. And they get a nice benefit package.
I think he's
going to
get it.
Definitely above average.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I've been pretty quiet, Mr. Chair.
You're doing a great job, Representative.
Anyway, I was excited to hear. I almost wanted to run out and call some relatives I know are unemployed and say, hey, guess what? Guess who's hiring? Anyway, but I had a job when I was, 14 or 15, working for, it was called Condor Enterprises at the time, out of Clackamas. And anyway, I think I credit that job with turning me Republican. That was my first, I got my first real paycheck, and I was so sad to see all the taxes and everything taken out of it. But anyhow, I'm wondering, what are the barriers to the drivers getting into the industry? You've talked about the barriers for the trucking industry itself to get the drivers, but what's holding back the drivers?
There are a few. The biggest is you have to have your CDL. And to get your CDL, that's about a $5,000 program, that's what we need the tuition dollars for. You have to get the training before you get the job. We've been able to enhance that training in our state so that you don't just get a CDL. You get a higher level of experience that should get you a better job. That is the number one barrier. There are other barriers, and I think one of them is ignorance. One of the things that I've been doing is talking to some of our K-12 programs. There's not a single school counselor that says, I think you should look into truck driving as a career.
All college.
Because they just don't know it. There is a basic ignorance. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is increase people's understanding of what truck driving careers can offer folks and bring that into the K-12 system and into our communities. Steve, is there anything you'd add to that?
No, I think that's right on for
trying now. All right. Well, I really appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you
so much. Thank you, Teresa, for helping us with our ABD.
You're welcome.
She's the best in the building. Smartest person in the room. All right. Ken Armstrong, Bud Shoemake, and Keith Levitt. Mr. Levitt's had the wonderful opportunity to be before a committee I'm on 2 days in a row. Isn't he fortunate? Go ahead, guys. Whoever wants to go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Ken Armstrong. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Ports Association. I'm really going to kick off the presentation with a very lengthy biographical introduction of both of my fellow panelists, as well as a long history of the ports industry. But decided, since that's probably not my best interest, I'm just going to do a very quick transition over to my fellow panelists. One of the things that is most important, obviously, and you've heard it a little bit here this morning, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it, is recapitalization of infrastructure programs. Clearly, a big part of the economic turnaround is just simply the economy itself doing what it needs to do to grind through the process. But one of the things that local government can do is assist businesses getting located on the ground. And the way that we do that best, the most efficient manner for us to do that, is to have the state be a partner with us by recapitalizing and investing in the infrastructure programs. Specifically, I'm talking about the Special Public Works Fund within the Oregon Business Development Department. Obviously, this is the wrong time of climate to be asking for new money, but I can't get off the dais without saying that that's just an important, vital element for the ports. With that, I want to introduce Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland, followed by Bud Shoemake from the Port of Toledo. That is going to give you two different perspectives, two very different sized ports in the state of Oregon. There's 23 ports here in the state, and this is a broad cross section of two of them. So, with that, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for having us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Keith Levitt, General Manager of Business Development and Properties with the Port of Portland, and I have to speak in PowerPoint this morning. We put together a real catchy title to my slides. None of you would hire me as a campaign manager. I can't get anything in a slogan. But I do want to talk about industrial land, brownfield, and how international service all are key parts of creating jobs. To do that first, just a little bit of history and background. The Port of Portland, certainly along with our state, is born from the geography that we're from. We are at the nexus of two major rivers. The port was actually formed in the late 1800s by the legislature to dredge a shipping channel from the ocean, and that dredging mission continues today. The 43-foot channel deepening project is 1 year away, and due to a great partnership really between the state legislature in both Oregon and Washington and the federal government to get that project done. That project is absolutely key to our competitiveness in the future. We're really blessed in this region, in this state, with great rail infrastructure. It's why we've had such a traded sector economy that has grown as really our foundation over the years, and I would say that's our key to the future. We also happen to have great interstate access, I-5 and I-84. We have been, this is really the underpinning of why this traded sector economy oriented towards Asia has grown. Last but not least is the upriver barge navigation system, which actually extends 465 miles from the ocean to Lewiston, Idaho. This creates, on a series of locks and dams and ports, an amazing export funnel to the world of agricultural products. And so this is really an underpinning of the Oregon economy. We think it needs to continue, but there are some key challenges that we need to address in order to do that. At the port, just very briefly, we're a unified port from the standpoint of we own the International Airport. We have our airport in Troutdale and in Hillsboro, but we're also a marine and an industrial development port. So we have four marine terminals, we have four business parks, and then three airports. And so with that, there's a lot of breadth to the operation. The market that we serve is the state of Oregon. It's not just the metropolitan region, even though that is our jurisdictional boundary. So the port facilities, starting at Terminal 2, downtown Portland, this is a general cargo facility. Terminal 4 is home to Toyota Auto Import facility. Moving downriver on the Willamette, we've got Rivergate Industrial District. This is really the state's number one industrial park. We have two international facilities there, terminals. Terminal 5, home to Columbia Grain, one of the major grain exporters in the United States. Also home to Canadian potash that is exported out of Terminal 5. It makes it to Portland from unit train activity flowing from Saskatoon, Canada. Potash is used in fertilizers around the world. Terminal 6 is our international container shipping terminal. We've had a couple of great new announcements on Terminal 6 in the last month. We took a long-term lease for a private operator, a partnership with a company called ICTSI, International Container Services, Inc. That's a 25-year lease. That's going to give Oregon, it's going to give the port great global market depth. They own 12 different facilities in 18 different countries around the world. This is a great opportunity for us to stabilize the container business, which has been very unstable, particularly in the current market environment, and grow our volume in the future, which is key to job creation. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. Other facilities moving upriver from Terminal 6, West Haven Island, potentially in long-term future marine reserve for marine terminal development, Portland Airport, Troutdale, and then our newest industrial park, Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, which I'll also highlight later. So trade and transportation, industrial land are all key underpinnings of our economy. I think you've seen a lot of the statistics before about the importance of trade to our economy. We're the ninth most trade-dependent state in the nation. The relationship to jobs is very strong, and the relationship to exports is very strong. I think you heard from your prior panelists, particularly in the ag community, how important it is for us to be able to export our products. We make them here, we export them, we receive wealth in our community with that. We're the fifth largest export-supported job base in the U.S. One in five jobs are trade-related in our state. These are good jobs. I think an interesting statistic the Oregon Employment Department came up with, for every $1 million in export sales, Oregon loses, for every drop of $1 million in export sales, we lose 10 jobs. We lost $6.5 billion in export sales during the really difficult days in the recession, and had the countered job loss from that. Exports are starting to pick up, so there's, I think, good news moving forward. Just to give you a sense of the exports that come through our facilities at the Port of Portland, value-added agricultural commodities, paper, wood products, scrap metal. On the air cargo side, it's more of the high-tech footwear and then the perishable products. Imports are also very key, and I'll talk about the relationship to imports and keeping international carrier service in our region. But the import side, we import furniture, tires, shoes, apparel and glass on the marine through our container facility. And then on the air cargo, it's high tech and it's apparel as two of the major commodities. The port is particularly challenged, and I think the state is particularly challenged on keeping and expanding international service, and both on the marine side and on the air side. So in black, you can see this is the Delta Northwest connection that we have to Amsterdam on the air service side, and then to Japan on heading on the Asia Pacific side. So from air service, we're one of the smallest markets in the U.S. that has transcontinental and trans-Pacific direct air service in our community. And because we are so trade dependent, it's a critical factor in our business climate. Our ability to recruit new companies to invest here oftentimes has a lot to do with having direct air service to those major continents that they need to reach. It's very similarly on the marine side. We have direct access to areas in Europe, South America, and Asia. But our ability to retain international marine carriers come up the river, call it the Port of Portland, when they're really driven by import demand. Imports pay better. They have higher rates. They're just higher value commodities. We need those imports because carriers want the imports, but we really need the carriers here in Portland so that our exporters don't have to pay extra costs to send their products through other ports at a much higher cost. So carrier service, keeping it here in Portland, is an area that we're particularly focused on. We think we need to have more incentives to compete, and that's been a big challenge. A year and a half ago, the port had a fairly extraordinary moment where we thought we were going to lose the Delta connections to Asia, potentially Europe, and frankly, we had to step up quickly with an incentive that would be very difficult for us to do again. And so it really raised the issue that we need some of our public partners to come to the table with us. The benefit from that service is certainly statewide. We've talked, we've heard some of the comments around basic industries, diverse jobs. That's really who resides in the port's business parks. We are really here to serve the traded sector, the trucking industry, the rail industry, the ag community, and they're really the people who reside in our parks and who are frankly have great jobs. I think the issue for us is that we're out of land. We're at a unique moment in our history at the Port of Portland. Really, after about 30 or 40 years of developing Rivergate, fully developing Swan Island, which you see in this picture, we are just about out of available shovel-ready property, and that's a significant policy issue, not only for the Port of Portland, but for the metro region in the Portland area and really for the state. So the issue of land availability and particularly larger parcels that are near major transportation facilities, that's a huge issue for us. One way you go at that is brownfield redevelopment, and we've really been pioneering in that arena. What you see here is an amazing state-of-the-art FedEx distribution center that is about to open this fall. This is at full build-out will be about 550,000 square feet, about $130 million invested by FedEx in this facility, and 900 jobs that will be created from this. And you know, why are they here? They're here really because there's an interstate nearby, and it's a region that they can, it's an area that they can serve the greater Pacific Northwest from. These are very good jobs. The story of this site is an interesting one. We began due diligence on this, what was a Superfund site, former Reynolds Aluminum, almost 10 years ago, and it took us about 5 years to complete our due diligence. No private investor is going to do that. No private developer is going to do that. I'm convinced that if we didn't get into this and have the patience that was necessary for this development, you essentially see a fence up around the old aluminum facility. This is also inside the urban growth boundary, so we didn't have to go into a new greenfield area, perhaps on farmland. So this is, I think, an exciting prospect for the future of the metro area. We're going to be able to bring on about 350 acres over time of available industrial land. But the cost of getting there is one that I know we can't duplicate that again. It's something that the port has financially constrained to the point where putting out all of that capital, almost $30 million to date, it simply is not going to pencil without more tools from the economic development folks, particularly at the state. And so we've been in very good discussions about legislative concepts with Business Oregon to bring to you next session on how we incentivize international service and industrial development. So we've got more available industrial sites in the right places to be able to compete in the future for new business investment. This just gives you a sense, this is my last slide, the phase out of the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. FedEx is on 78 acres. The area in yellow is our phase one parcels. We built the road and utility structures in here to serve both phase one and phase two. Phase two will come online over the next few years as we move forward with that development. And with that, I'm happy to conclude my comments and answer any questions.
Right after Mr. Shoemaker, we're going to take a five-minute break. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Don't get in a hurry.
If Mr. Shoemaker may look like a quiet and unassuming port manager from Toledo, but once upon a time, he was about the most vicious basketball player on the Oregon coast. Quick elbows. Yeah, yeah. I've been waiting a long time to try and get back at him. I'm going to take a hard call.
All right. Well, go ahead with that, sir.
Thank you.
We're a friendly bunch.
All right. I appreciate that. I'm not used to this, so bear with me.
You're doing great.
My name is Bud Shoemaker. I'm the port manager of the Port of Toledo. We're upriver from NOAA, about 14 miles, or Newport. This is the port's 100th anniversary this year. It's also the anniversary in Lincoln County, anyway, of the port of Newport and Alsea. We have about a taxing district about 443 square miles, most of it rural. One of the things that I'd like you all to think about and get behind is that this last year the state funded a statewide ports plan to take a look at how ports in Oregon are structured and compare us to other states and how they run things. And an honest, open look that all ports contributed and took seriously. I believe that was just passed by the Infrastructure Authority, that the final plan on that. But you know, there's 23 ports of us, three deep draft ports, but most of us are pretty small and rural, and we're kind of dug in on a rough coastline with not all the attributes of, say, Washington State, where you have naturally deep draft areas. And we are scratching out a living in economic development primarily with industrial sites, marinas, boat yards. The Port of Toledo is just in the final throes of reopening a boat yard that has been closed on Yaquina Bay for the last just darn near 2 years. It's the only large haul out, anything over 70 tons. And Newport, I think there's 1,400 slips there, but is second only to Seattle in the size of its distant water fleet. And these boats are, you know, 65 feet and over. And they spend on maintenance every year, average $350,000. And this isn't fuel and oil. This is actual maintenance. So, and Toledo's played a big part of that. We've been the service part of maintaining a lot of those fleet, and we bring boats from outside of the state of Oregon. A lot of boats come down from Alaska, boats from the South Pacific. And with the closure of that boatyard, we've been seeing our people going elsewhere for their work. Some of them go in state, some go out of state. But it's important that that's opened, and it will be shortly. One of the things that is good, that you guys have done a good job with, is the IRC team. They've been real responsive in to the Port of Toledo and the Port of Newport. One of the programs that I really support, and I think we need to make sure we protect and support planning and marketing. It allows small ports, any port, to do proper planning so that when opportunities come along, they're not making dumb mistakes. Probably the one of the single most important things that happened is on the NOAA was that port planning and marketing stepped up and funded a plan to make the presentation to bring NOAA to Oregon. So I think it's real important. You know, we are also faced with all the regulatory regulations. We're on the water, and so dealing with all the permitting agencies is challenging, and it's very costly, and a lot of it unnecessary. I had a dredging project last year that was funded by the federal government through the Corps of Engineers, and I had a state regulatory agency get concerned about the dredging, and next thing they were calling NIMS, state police, DEQ. By the time this was all spinning around, the Corps called time out. They continued to pay the contractor for about 4 or 5 days, and by the time, you know, nobody could make up their mind on time, so contractor pulled out. We weren't able to finish our dredging, and you know, we believe we're going to be recapitalized with stimulus money, but that's not right. You know, things can be solved easier than that, and for no good reasons. So I do appreciate what the state has done. You know, parts of it are great, parts of it, you know, are challenging. And, you know, I've been involved in ports for a little over 30 years, and I see the complication of the permitting agencies somehow need to be streamlined. You know, ERT has really stepped in and helped quite a bit, but still, it's been costly. And that's about it, unless you have any questions.
Do you know my good friend and mentor, Alan Brown?
Oh, I do.
He's a fine American, and everyone in Oregon should go to Alan Brown's Les Schwab Tire in Newport, Oregon, just like I did, and buy their tires. He's a fine American. God bless him and his family.
He has a store in Toledo, too.
Pardon me?
He has a store in Toledo, too.
You know, if you guys had to build this infrastructure today, you wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
We had some anti-development activists in here earlier, and they had to run out and kill some jobs. But you know what? I really appreciate what you're doing. I really appreciate the jobs you create. I'm very interested in the unnecessary, prohibitive regulations and the activists behind that. I really want you to come here next January, before January, with language. Let's get people back to work in this state. So,
sure.
All right.
Representative. Very quickly, because I don't want to be the only one not to editorialize, but I'd like to thank you for coming. I'm probably one of the few people in the legislature that has a background in international trade, and what I appreciate today is you coming and explaining that international trade is actually about creating jobs, and if we can, and manufacturing jobs specifically, because if we can make product here and ship it, then we can create more good-paying jobs. And I know specifically we've had, in my past career, we had a lot of problems finding containers, getting good pricing to be able to ship out of Oregon. So we'd have to go up to Washington or we'd have to go down to L.A. So I'd like to see whatever we can do to help make sure that we create good manufacturing jobs here and are able to ship out of our port. So, again, thank you for coming and explaining that. I don't think that's a message we hear nearly enough.
I couldn't agree more. But you know what? Prohibitive, unnecessary activist regulation is not an editorial. It's a fact. It's a fact. It's not an opinion. And you just spelled it out for us. Any further questions of these fine gentlemen before we go take a break? All right. Give up good work, guys. I'm going to take a five-minute break. We'll be back at 10:05. kind enough to come right on up here. Guys, go right ahead. Introduce yourselves. Let's hear what the timber industry has to say.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, Chris Garber, Oregon Forest Industries Council, thanks for the opportunity this morning. Appreciate this very much. I think the only good thing that we can say about being in the recession that we're in now is that we're out of the depression that we've been in for about 18 months. So things are looking better. That's always a good sign, and this is a good way to maybe move us further and faster. Yes, it's what you guys could do to help us, and the simple answer for me is harvest more timber off the state forest lands. If you've been following that issue, the media has characterized a major shift in the tectonic plates, and that's simply not true. I think it was symbolic that they made a decision, and I appreciate that very much that they did, but the on-the-ground difference is going to be very, very small. OFIC believes that they could harvest another 100 million feet off of those lands in the North Coast, and conservatively that's $40 million into the state and county coffers and the addition or retention of 1,200 to 1,400 jobs. So it's pretty significant, and that's something solid that you could do. Secondly, you heard before from our agriculture friends some things that the state government could not do. The Department of Environmental Quality is proposing right now, and the EQC is planning to adopt in December, some pretty strict new water quality standards based on some fish consumption rates, which are getting kind of down in the technical weeds, but some rates that are significantly more conservative than the EPA even requires. What that's going to mean, I don't really know, but my guess is that they're going to ask farmers and timberland owners to do more. And I think the only thing I'm sure of, if they do that, is that we're going to shift production to somewhere else that doesn't have the requirements that we have to meet our demands, which is kind of your classic lose-lose situation. And those jobs will be gone, and that's a bad thing. So one last thing I would like to say is Mr. Schossler from the Business Oregon was talking about a business loan program of $5 million. That would be great. But to put that in context, the EPA at the national level is proposing new air emission standards that for one facility would probably cost between $2 and $10 million. So that pollution control addition for one plant, for one of our facilities, would completely wipe out that loan fund. So the magnitude of what's happening on the environmental front, excuse me, is pretty significant. And you guys could weigh in as a legislature, as individual members, to try to do something about that. Final comment, ORS 183 something 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 requires a statement of financial impact on any new rules developed by any of the commissions and departments. And I'm not sure how well that's enforced, but my guess is that there's not a lot of activity on that, and that's another thing that we could be a little bit more cognizant of. So that's my specifics. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller. I'm the public affairs manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about our industry, and particularly our company. Here comes the commercial. So the Weyerhaeuser commercial is that we own about 940,000 acres in the state of Oregon. We employ about 1,340 people, our associates, in about seven facilities throughout Oregon. Our principal counties and where we operate is Lynn and Lane County. And we really do appreciate this opportunity to talk about some specifics, which as I've thought about this opportunity to talk to you, it's difficult to say anything different than what you've already heard in terms of regulatory streamlining. And that's not to say that there isn't a role for state agencies and the regulations that we operate under. It's how do we do that in an efficient way, and perhaps taking different looks at how we do that. It's also difficult to say that there's a silver bullet to solving our issue in our forest sector. I'll give you a quick statistic. In 2006, which was a very good year for our sector, we were at 2.4 million starts, and that includes multifamily and single resident housing starts. In 2010, where we are today, we're a little less than 800,000 starts combined. And yes, things are looking a little better. It's a little soft out there right now. Things looked a little better the first quarter of this year. folks that are involved with our industry know things are getting a little soft out there, so we're worried about what we might see in terms of a double dip recession. However, having said that, I think there are some things that the legislature can keep an eye on that would be very helpful for our industry. One is renewable energy. Our core business is timberlands. We, as I said, we own 940,000 acres in this state. Across the nation, we own a little less than 6 million acres. And anything we can do to add value to that timber supply, be it a home, remodeling, or whatever the case may be, another part of that equation is renewable energy. There are things being talked about at the national level, whether or not the use of trees for biomass, electricity generation, whether it's carbon neutral or whatever. If we get those policies wrong at the state level, then we're going to take an opportunity away from our forest landowners in this state. It's incumbent upon this body to get our policies right around renewable energy, and we have a real opportunity. We're all in this thing together. We've worked with our utility partners. We can work with our ENG partners, our ENGO partners, but this body has an opportunity to look at that and get it right, and not what I would echo what Mr. Salzgiver said, which is kind of do no wrong or do no harm. And I ditto that, because we really have an opportunity to get that right. Another thing that I think that is important to talk about, and this is something that I share with you. This spring I had an opportunity to sit with a national group. It's a Forest Products and Labor Management Committee at the national level. Many of the trade folks, many of the trade unions that you'll hear from later on belong to that at the national level. And there's some things that we're really concerned about together collectively. One is this conversation around green buildings and having policies in place that discriminate against wood products or discriminate against certain forest certification systems. Oregon's done a pretty fair job of being balanced at looking at that and not having any discriminatory policies in place that would favor, for example, Forest Stewardship Council wood grown versus Sustainable Forestry Initiative wood. I know that's a lot of acronyms and stuff in the weeds, but what we look at it as being inclusive, and it's something that we have to keep our eye on. And when we talk about green building codes and standards and those things, to ensure that we're not doing anything that would discriminate against the tree growers in this state. So I encourage you to not engage in those kind of policies. I think the other thing that I'd like to hit on in my remaining minutes is this public-private partnership is important. Job is important. It doesn't matter who's employed. Doesn't matter who has the job, because when they have confidence in their job and it's stable, they're going to buy homes, they're going to remodel their homes, they're going to do those kinds of things that will stimulate our sector. I would just ask that the state be careful in terms of picking the winners and losers. What we see sometimes in the policies is that a sector gets more favoritism because they're the, you know, kind of the sector of the day. Just be careful in how you look at those priorities. And with that, I would say that we haven't done a very good job of investing in our state natural resource agency budgets. Some of you folks have heard this over and over again over several biennium, and I know it's a competition, and there are three big buckets out there. But the natural resource agencies get less than 2%. I mean, that's a rounding error for the K-12 budget. I'm not here to argue against that. I'm just simply saying that if you want to invest in timber and ag, you've got to make the investment in those state natural resource agencies that drive those sectors, Department of Ag and the Department of Forestry. And the Department of Forestry has taken an unfair hit over the last two biennium in their budgets for perhaps good reasons, whatever the case may be. But we can't sustain that. And we have a cost share, a shared responsibility formula that landowners share in with that agency. And you folks have to look at that and say, is that good for the sector? And I think the answer would be no. So we're engaged with the department to help work through their budget this next biennium. I'd encourage you folks, even if you're not on the committees, to get actively engaged and think about those kind of natural resource agency budgets that help drive those
sectors that help drive Oregon's prosperity. And with that, I'll hush up. Oh, I'm sorry. One more, which is workforce development. I think you heard a lot about workforce development. We are in the same stages as many, many of our mature industries where our employees are starting to retire. I happen to be in the middle of that baby boom wave. Another 10 years, I'm out of here. But many of my colleagues that I started with are starting to retire. Our workforce is in that stage, and we have to have investments in our community colleges. Our skilled workforce absolutely need that. Even if we're unable to provide the manufacturing jobs or unable to get those jobs going, they need the retraining. They need to have those programs healthy, and we need as a state to invest in those in the community college level. Absolutely vital to us. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm with Conkling, Fiskeman, McCormick. I'm here representing Associated Oregon Loggers, Boise, and Boise Cascade. And unlike my shameless partner, I'm not going to make a commercial about those companies other than Boise Cascade is better. on the premise, how can the state of Oregon help business create jobs? Chris Jarmer explained how cutting 1 million board feet of state timber is one excellent way because it produces 12 to 14 direct jobs in the process of preparing those timber sales at the Department of Forestry, cutting the trees, putting them on trucks, or making them into lumber, other forest products like plywood or paper. So that's a traditional way to create jobs is to start at the bottom with a basic resource. This job creation for basic jobs also has an impact on other aspects of the economy. We need to be able to feed these people, so grocery stores, they have kids, teachers need to be employed, and so there's a multiplication factor that increases these basic jobs, and so with indirect jobs. And so cutting trees is really long used way to create jobs, is to cut trees. Now, it's not quite as easy as that, and the chair mentioned that he might challenge people to vote against one of these natural resource job creation bills. Unfortunately, and I'm new to this process, but I've experienced that not always does natural resource legislation come to a vote. It's hard to believe, but a couple sessions ago, there was a piece of legislation to increase timber production from our state-owned forest lands, and nobody got to vote on it. In fact, I think the governor wrote a letter to the committee chair, not this committee, and threatened him, and that there was no hearing after that. And so this bill not only did not get a vote, but it didn't get a hearing. So it's not quite as easy as putting people on the line because different things happen. And the other thing is that although the chair's opening comments are terrific, quick means different things to different people. And Mr. Jarmer mentioned the Board of Forestry process that they've been going through since, I think it was 2007, to increase timber production from those state forest lands in Northwest Oregon. And just a few weeks ago, they made a decision to slightly increase, but it hasn't happened yet. It'll be a long time. So I guess, you know, Vice Chair Cameron said he wants specifics, and that doesn't really take a law because the Board of Forestry has figured out that legally they can cut trees. And so what it would take would be some urging from the legislature that the Board of Forestry really ought to, you know, get on with the life so that we could get people employed, loggers cutting trees, truckers hauling trees, and mill workers milling them to forest products. Besides the Northwest Oregon State Forest, there it's and this gets to specifics and trying to get people accountable. Oregon also owns some state forests in southern Oregon. It's called the Elliott State Forest, and you folks don't really have authority over the Elliott State Forest. And the State Land Board does. The Land Board is the three people, the governor and the secretary of state and the treasurer. But the Elliott State Forest is what's known as common school fund land. So schools benefit from the receipts, not to mention the jobs created, the basic jobs and the indirect jobs, but schools benefit from that. And the Elliott used to be a productive forest. And when I say used to be, it was a long time ago because I worked there. But now it hasn't been, and the State Land Board is trying to make it more productive. In fact, in October of 2009, the chairman of the State Land Board, Governor Kulongoski, listened to an update on the plans for the Elliott State Forest, and he expressed to them for the Department of State Lands and the Oregon Department of Forestry to get with it and make the Elliott State Forest more productive, because one, it's common school land and schools are hurting, and two, he was worried about you legislators coming in and trying to do something and like requiring the state to sell the Elliott State Forest. Well, we're not advocating that, but anyway, that was October of 2009, and in February of 2010, while you folks are having a short special session, supplemental session, the Land Board met to make a decision on this issue that the governor kicked off in October of 2009, and they're going to get right on it. And the decision was to accept the recommendation from the agencies to go 2 more years. So they're going to negotiate with the federal government for two more years before they put their foot down and say, we have to get more. So it's frustrating to listen to people from the governor on down say we have to do this, and have to do this means 2 more years. Now, we will have a new land board because we've got a new treasurer and we're going to have a new governor. So there will be chances to readdress this issue on the Elliott, not to mention the Northwest Oregon State Forest. And finally, it's not just state forest land. You folks know better than I do that the state forest land is very small. In Oregon, the big picture are federal forest lands. And that's another opportunity that, and I don't know specifically what you can do, but there's not a bill. But in western Oregon, there's 2 million acres of land that was formerly owned by the Oregon and California Railroad and has been revested for 18 of our 36 counties. They get receipts from those. They're called O&C lands. Well, the U.S. Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management manages those lands, and they spent about 8 years coming up with a new plan. And the new plan was the Western Oregon Plan Revisions, and they adopted that plan in late 2008. And one of the first things to Obama administration did is that they withdrew that, quote, whopper. They withdrew that plan. And that plan was scientifically sound, and it did the outrageous thing, proposed an increase in timber harvest while it was still less than half of the biological sustainable production from those forest lands, and it was withdrawn. But the problem is, well, that's the big problem, but nothing's happened since. And these counties have welfare payments from the federal government that are going to expire this fall. And so it would be great to have the governor and some of you powerful folks let the Obama administration know that we need a new Western Oregon plan revision. I'm running out of time.
You're doing great.
But the smartest person in the room said that I could have 2 spots because there was 2 names there and I only brought 1. So I have nothing else. Glad to answer any questions.
Well, yeah, thanks, Rob. And you know what? There are people that are held accountable. There's the speaker assigns bills to the chair of a committee, and then they hear the bill. And if it goes to the committee to die, then we know the speaker and the Senate president are responsible for that. It doesn't matter who the speaker is. It doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican. That's how the process works. So there is someone to hold accountable for these bills. I'm confident. I don't speak for him, but I would be willing to bet that the good chair of the Ag, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee would be happy to hear your timber concepts in that committee. I had the pleasure of being on that committee last session, and I'd love to be on it again, because I know I can say you got one vote. I'm very interested in these rule changes. They work within the process we, the legislature, give them. And I think that's lost on a lot of people. I'm very interested in the financial impact of these rule changes. And I got to tell you, everyone in this state uses toilet paper. Therefore, they demand a wood fiber industry. They demand it. We demand it. And I want it coming from Oregon, where we have, once again, the most rigid and strict and sustainable labor, work safety, and environmental standards in the world. You guys know better than I do. This is the best place in the world to grow trees, right here. And it's criminal that it's burning and rotting while we have 250,000 people on unemployment. We have 1 in 5 on food stamps. And our infrastructure is falling down. It's unbelievable. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, that what's real sad here is that it reminds me of a person that's sitting around gold and it's laying on the ground, yet they're digging in the ground to find it. That's what Oregon is. Because we do have the natural resource, we do have the, well, what's left of the timber industry. And what I mean by what's left is, when I was growing up here, you know, you had all kinds of opportunities to work and to work in a manufacturing facility. But having said that, that's gone away. Now, it's up to us, I think, and I agree with the chair, it's up to us to go back and wrestle, arm wrestle with the federal government, with the BLM. If they're not going to keep their part of the bargain on the ONC lands, then they need to give it back to the state of Oregon. If they have 120 years of cutting of federal lands, they need to turn that over to the state of Oregon as well if they're not going to do anything with it. Because that land right now is turning into a brush facility. And that's all it is. I can take you to units that are private, owned privately, right next to a federal Forest Service unit, and it's between night and day. Whereas the federal unit spent 3 or 4 times the amount of money to sustain that and reforest it, and a complete failure, and yet the private industry has a vibrant forest because they take care of it. We could take 120 years of cut, turn it over to the state of Oregon, and do a 120-year harvest plan and never run out of timber in this state. And we could sustain that forever and never touch a piece of old growth if that's the desire. But the problem is with this state is that we have the tail wagging the dog. We have too many people in the minority that's dictating the majority. And I feel that until the majority stands up and says enough is enough and tells the federal government the same thing and the court system the same thing, it will continue on this path.
Representative Wick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've already spoken about the wide utilization of forest products, and I wanted to ask this group, if I were to be looking at starting up a new tissue mill somewhere in the world, would Oregon likely be one of the top 3 or 4 places that I would be looking at to build that tissue mill? And if so, why? If not, why not?
That's called the softball.
Well, I'll take a stab at it. I mean, every region competes. We definitely have an opportunity in this region because we have at least 2 out of the 3 principal cost drivers in this state that allow us to be competitive. I think we have a very well-trained workforce. I mean, there's no question about it. We got to continue to invest in that. I do believe that our natural resource, our fiber costs are competitive. One thing that's lost in the conversation is, as a timber grower, we definitely have a competitive advantage to the south of us in those markets down there in California, huge sixth of the economy driver for us. Pacific Rim, you know, et cetera. You know, so I think the Northwest definitely has that. The challenge is the we definitely can improve our permitting process. It needs to be one-stop shop. We've said this over and over and over again, and I know there's been some responses to that, to the best that people can do, but we can do better in terms of making it a one-stop shop, go to one place for the permitting aspect. These are incredibly complex greenfield facilities. We're not asking, you wouldn't ask the state to alleviate its environmental needs on those levels, but we could definitely streamline that process. I can't be real specific, but I just know I've heard that many, many times over within our own manager's system in terms of, you know, the difficulty. I mean, you at the federal permitting level relative to air emission and water quality, those permitting processes that are delegated back to the state of Oregon, we could make that more efficient. We need those, but we need to make it more efficient. And the other thing that I think that is a looming problem on the horizon that would be a bit of a challenge is the cost of energy. And that has been very, very competitive for us up until the last decade or so. Maybe I shouldn't be so critical there, but at least as we move down the road for renewables, we see those costs going up. We've got to continue to take advantage that we can of our energy costs in this state. It continues to be an advantage to us, but we ought to look at our energy policy that, along with our utility partners, to ensure that we can keep the costs manageable. And I think they've tried to do that as well. But I think our state needs to look at those investments in renewables, and if we can work those priorities so that we keep our energy costs down. But if we let the energy costs get out of whack, then we will be at a major disadvantage with other regions to produce tissue for the theoretical that you put out there.
Thank you.
May I also reply to that, Mr. Chairman? And partly to Representative Esquivel's point, Oregon's still the largest softwood lumber producer in the nation, and that's significant. And we've got some incredible advantages here in the state. The workforce is one. The fact that we can grow Douglas fir is another incredible advantage. So the answer is we could be, but some other things work against us. And so we're not down. We're down a little bit, but we're not out. So I would say, yeah, we're going to be in there.
I would just say, based on Representative Witt's personal knowledge, that we really, and all of us are foresters, we're not attorneys, but an attorney would say not everybody has clean hands in this debate, because I had to bring this schedule in, but fortunately it's printed on Boise paper. All the paper the state uses is Boise paper from his district. So, you know, we need to think broader than when we turn off the faucet on things like paper. Well, that affects people's jobs.
That's right.
Right in Oregon.
Well, paper's welcome in my office. I don't have this electronics.
Not tissue paper. I mean, real.
Representative Thatcher, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you. Earlier, one of you was mentioning something about administrative rules and how agencies were supposed to assess the impact or determine what the impact is on small business, et cetera, et cetera. That was my bill back in 2005, and I'm sad to hear that it's not being implemented fully. But I'm sure, you know, in speaking in defense, this is going to be odd coming from me, but in defense of the executive branch, I hope that they can hear from people in the industry and say, this is what you're supposed to be doing, and then you can point to the law. They're people. There's a lot of laws and a lot of rules, and I just hope that that's the case. But then again, you do have... We make all these laws, and you depend on the executive branch to actually execute the laws. So I'm hoping that you can educate them as to that, because that's a huge impact. It's not a very sexy topic, talking about administrative rules, but it has a huge impact on industry.
such as yours and all small businesses across the state. So I want to hear about it if this isn't working. So this is a big peeve of mine. So thanks.
You bet.
And I just want to emphasize, there's a picture up in the house lounge where they're dragging a log down the trail and dust is flying. It's like a 100-year-old picture. And you'd think that people think that's how we still log in this state. I haven't had anybody come up here and say, we're not interested in water quality, we're not interested in habitat, we're not in... Nobody cares more about the health of that forest than the people that work in it. The men and women and the families who live out there drink that water. It's just a country. It's false that the forestry industry doesn't care about the health of the forest. And I every logger in the state goes fishing, I bet you. So it ain't like they don't care about fishing.
Hunting.
What's that?
And hunting.
And hunting.
Too.
God bless them. That's right.
Now, spring turkey hunts.
Well, there you go.
So I'm wasting time.
We better get on. Go out there and kill some of them geese, too. Anyway, thank you for coming, guys. I really appreciate it. Bill Kludig, Mike Sullivan. Go ahead, guys.
Thank you, Chair. Chair of Committee, Bill Kludig, Carpenters Industrial Council. I'm glad Ralph went first because he's better talking about forests. But I can give you a few facts and figures on the Elliott right quick. When the U.S. Forest Service moved in there, 80 to 90 jobs disappeared right there. It has cost the schools in this state over $100 million in lack of revenue because of the low timber harvest. And I'll come right out front and say it. I asked the schools for help on this issue years ago, and they flat refused. What we need to do in the Elliott is to tell the U.S. Forest Service, thanks, but no thanks, get out. That's what we need to do. If that was a private forest, if you owned it, if I owned it, we could follow every federal law, every state law, and we could take 60 million board feet a year out of that forest. With U.S. Forest Service in there, we went down to 12 million one year. We never hardly ever got over 20, 15, 14 million feet. There's where the $100 million is lost. As far as the ONC County, the Western Oregon plan, I have a letter here from the Interior Secretary appointing me to a four-year term on the Resource Advisory Committee for BLM. I was cautioned when I applied for this that it's very time-consuming with all the work, with the Whopper plan going through. If I really wanted to take the time to do this, I felt it was my obligation to do it. With the failure of the Whopper, my next letter came. I did get a folder this thick of items we was going to have to work on. The next letter came in. It said, due to the failure of the plan, we could probably wrap up all of our work in one day. The last part of next month, I'll spend one day going over all the plans for BLM, Salem District, from Tillamook clear down to Eugene in one day. There was 1,000-plus jobs right there. 1,000 jobs went down. The state needs to call BLM up. Call the Interior Secretary is pretty busy right now. We need to invite him back out here right now, sit down, take the forest plan, and get something on the ground working. Right now, we're looking at years again. ONC Counties was touched on. 2012, they get $20 million. I told the governor just the other day, sir, that won't even pay the county's postage bill in 2012. I sat through a meeting yesterday. One place we could save some money real quick. Not much, but real quick. We do not need the economic forecasters that we have working these halls today. I sat through a meeting yesterday. Again, we're on this jobless recovery. They're saying by 2013 we'll be okay. I'm telling you they're dead wrong. every one of these forecasters go back and they say, well, back in 1980, Oregon was one of the leading states to climb out of the hole. How soon they forget. In 1980, the timber industry, my members, was the main economic driver in this state. We're the ones that pulled Oregon out of the hole. We're not there today. We are not there today. And there's nobody to drag Oregon out of the hole unless you folks make some changes. We, just in today's paper, there's a group wanting to stop the building of the state hospital in Junction City. They have their ideas. But committee, I'm telling you, we better start that building today. The money's there. You appropriated the money. We got thousands of people out of work. What's going to happen? My thought on this is if that money gets slid away over into another corner, you know what's going to happen. You're going to have some fights on the floors of this House and Senate, and that money will disappear. The federal government is going to hang the state of Oregon over the mental health problem. And we don't want the federal government involved in our mental health situation. Look what they've done to our force. We need to look ahead. It was mentioned yesterday about all the green jobs that's going to be created. Thousands of them. 90% of these green jobs are tied to a tax credit. When that tax credit goes away, that job goes away. We need jobs at least when a person buys a new car on a 5-year contract, his job runs long enough to pay that car off. We don't have that today. I want to ask the committee one thing. How can we spend $120 million on a bridge project and not one survey stake is in the ground?
Unbelievable.
I don't mind Portland fighting over their bicycle trails, but when a bicycle holds up a bridge project that's choking the whole state of Oregon, something's wrong. For an example, in the paper the other day, state of Washington is going to get well over $600 million for a new high-speed train system track from Seattle to Portland. The article, this is from the federal government. The article went on to say, since Oregon did not have any plans for a high-speed system, they're going to help Oregon out with $69 million on the bridge project that they're still fighting over. There it stops. If Oregon would have had the plan presented to D.C. saying, we need the high-speed service clear down past Eugene, Cottage Grove, Grass Pass, the money would have been there. Cargo containers, we've heard about that. Coos Bay is the only place on the West Coast that's left for a cargo container site. We've already spent money. For the dredging, it hasn't been done yet, but I'm saying, let's get the bonding, let's get the groups together that want to go in there. They're wanting to go in there. Let's create those thousands of jobs, the building, the processing, the new distribution center on I-5. Coos County saved the railroad, a little highway work. We can have the distribution center in just below Roseburg. There's 1,000 jobs right there to run that. I'll leave us one thought. I don't think anybody in this room was here in 1930. But luckily, this country had a president that had a vision. And he called it the New Deal. And it worked. Committee, this is what Oregon needs. We need a New Deal. Thank you.
How many years do you work in the mill, Bill?
Pardon?
How many years did you work in the...
39 years, sir.
God bless you. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the
the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers in Oregon. And first off, I'd like to try and answer Representative Bradwitt's comment about where would you build a plant if you were going to produce tissue paper. And objectively, I would suggest that you go to China. It's the largest producer of pulp and paper as I talk soon, and coming online as I talk is Vietnam. And they are depleting the forests of Indonesia, which we don't have the ability, nor would we want to in this state. It is physically irresponsible to allow good-paying jobs that go for 25, 30 years to go overseas on the issue of what's considered trade when it's not fair. We cannot compete with China when they're making a dollar an hour, and now India is making 10 cents. On the environmental issue, AWPPW is very concerned about it. The rivers in Oregon are cleaner than anywhere in the world. You heard Bud Shoemake just talk, the Port of Portland report of Toledo speak, and on the way out I reminded him that they just had a river cleanup again this year, activated by the local union at the Toledo plant, Georgia Pacific, and the community and the kids. They've restored trails and things like this. As you pointed out, Chair, and so did Greg Miller, these people fish and hunt in the areas that they live. The biggest problem, I think, too, is back to Representative Witt's comment. If you're a venture capitalist or whatever, why would you gamble on Oregon when you can go somewhere else and make sure you get a return on your dollar? Everyone seems to think that the industrial people have all kinds of money in their pockets. Well, yes, maybe they do, but they're not going to put it here if they can get a better return somewhere else. AWPPW is on its last leg. It was formed in 1964. It is roughly now one half of what it was. And there's nothing worse for me than to see someone who is a productive person doing a good job, having family wages and benefits, lose it over stupid. And it is absolutely stupid to me to give away our industrial base of this country, which we have. And I could go on forever. Thank you.
No, thank you. Representative Kim.
Bill, I wanted to go back to your comment. Does the legislature yes. have the authority to kick the BLM out of the Elliott and other state forests?
Don't worry about
it. I would say, Chair, Committee, I would say yes. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife, that's a state forest, state owned by the state lands. They were invited in. We can sure invite them back out. And I will say again, sir, that we need to get BLM back here and sit down and get a plan working today.
A lot of cavalier people out there when we talk about job creation. You know, their attitude is, why are you hungry? I just ate. And they got some government job or some consulting job, and they don't care about those mill workers out there. They just simply don't care.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Yes,
I was county commissioner for 12 years and watched the demise of the ONC. And personally, I think working with the federal government on these issues is an incredible waste of energy. I mean, it doesn't work, it does. It works in the negative. You know, I guess my point to you is I know that if you wanted, I'd be happy to help you get a bill drafted if we can do that, and I'd be willing to sponsor it or co-sponsor it, and I'm sure there are others here who feel like I do. We have to take our forests back. They're our forests. I have property in Scottsburg. I play in the Elliott Forest all the time. Or what's left of it. You can't even walk through it anymore. It's a brush-covered, infested mess. And the elk herds have been completely destroyed by the lack of the care. And you can fish in the stream, sort of, but it's pretty steep in there, and there isn't much fishing up that high. You know, it's... But I think it's time if I don't know whether there's enough will here, and I don't know, you know, there are other lobbies that are very powerful in this thing, but we ought to go back to doing some logging, and that's a great place. I mean, I remember back in the 70s when I first started playing in the Elliott, We had these wonderful little clear cuts, and it was a fabulous place. I remember having to stop all the time to keep from running over the elk and the deer. That's not the case now.
Yeah,
and incidentally, a lot of it is also the gates on the surrounding properties are increasingly locked, and you can't get into the neighboring areas, and you can't even get into portions of the Elliott, I suspect. So I think there's a lot of anger and sentiment here about doing something different and maybe getting some of those jobs back. And I don't see any point in putting them in China or Vietnam or Brazil.
Where the trees don't grow back. Got my vote, Representative. Representative Thatcher, then Representative Witt. And then we got to get going.
Just a real quick comment. I'm real excited to see what happens with Utah's case. They're exercising eminent domain against the federal government, so it'll be interesting to see the outcome of that. I remember visiting the paper mill in Newburgh, and they're delighted that they're only 60% down now rather than 90. And it's ridiculous. But one of the things we hear from people say, well, you don't want to cut forests, you don't have a market for it. What do you say back to them?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, you say to them you have sustainable yields. You are responsible. There is a forest in Scandinavia that's been cultivated for 400 years, cyclically. So if it can be done there, it can be done here. There's a lot of things that we can do within our own parameters of this border.
I guess maybe let me clarify. Meaning there's no houses and there's nothing being built, therefore who are you going to sell it to? You wouldn't get a good price for it. That's what the con argument I hear all the time is. I'm just wondering how you respond to that.
Chair, Representative Thatcher, our history in the industry is it's like a roller coaster ride. It's always like this. We've had our ups, and then we've had our downs. But when we have our downs, we just pull our claws back in. We go back to straight time. Maybe one shift gets laid off, but the facility stays there. And when things turned around, now we aren't a problem this time. But the only thing that's getting made right now is foreclosure signs. But when it does come out, when we climb out, when the building straightens out, at least our facilities are there. We can kick back to work. But right now we're on long term, forever layoff, basically.
And we have to make sure that they don't make a bunch of rules, so when it does come back, you're ready to go and are kept from going out in the forest and making a living. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Chris Jarvis said earlier, we are the place that has the potential to be the world's largest timber producer. And as Representative Kennemer pointed out, the federal government is mismanaging our state's forests to the detriment of the people that live here. The federal government owns over half of our state's forests. And as Bill Cluding pointed out, it's a sick job that they do. And it's been a very, very long time that we've needed to have the discussion with the federal government of how forests ought to be managed, those that are managed by the federal government in the state. And I could think of no better place to begin that discussion than a bill that would presume to take back federal or state forests and place them back under state authority because they're being mismanaged by the federal government. It's a heck of a good place to start, Mr. Chairman.
Not my fault. Gentlemen, I really appreciate you coming
thank
down
you.
Here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've got to move on. I'm going to call Charles Alcock, Tashiana Wangler, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Colin Sears. And Mr. Alcock, you want to go first? You have a time sensitive thing going on here. Go ahead and go right in.
I don't think we can get the Elliott back, but we might. I'd be interested in seeing. You know, down there in Gardner was this gigantic.
Is Colin Sears here?
A month ago.
I don't know. Okay. All right. Get him next time. Go right ahead. Whenever you're ready.
Anything ever existed there. Mm-hmm. and it used to be a...
The Church Offler, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Alcock, and for the record, I'm the Economic Development Director for Portland General Electric, based in Portland, Oregon. At PGE, we work a lot with our state economic business development department, as well as our county and our city economic development professionals to keep jobs here in Oregon with existing businesses, to help those businesses grow, and to bring businesses here who don't have a presence in Oregon to understand the opportunities that they might have here in our state. I've been in this line of work for 25 years, and I, at last count, I'm probably hitting about 1,000 projects. Every year I do get to see many of the business projects that do happen in our state. One of the first points that I would like to share with the committee is the notion and the principle that job creation in Oregon and in anywhere else for that matter is a very long-term initiative. And I know that many of the decisions that are faced, that you face in your deliberations at every session of the legislature is focused on the biennium. But job creation is really a 5 or 10 year project. And it, I think it's very important for the committee to really be thinking in those terms. I was personally involved in the Sanyo Solar transaction that located a solar manufacturing facility here in Salem. That project, from the time the first inquiry came in till the time they made the decision to locate in Salem, was 6.5 years. And during that time, there was a core group of us from Business Oregon, as well as some of the communities that work with that company, and help them through and understand all the business opportunities that were here. And that's just one example. These kinds of situations also apply with local Oregon businesses that are here today looking to expand, looking to reconfigure whatever their particular manufacturing or business operations happen to be. The second piece is around consistency. We have many good programs today that our business development department as well as other agencies operate. The key here is to keep these programs consistent from year to year and from biennium to biennium. Rapid changes in programs creates market uncertainty. They begin to doubt that your commitment to a certain principle is still there, and you begin to lose traction from all the good image and all the good work that has led up to that particular point. So whatever the particular programs are, this long-term sense of consistency and perspective, I think, is very important. For example, there was a country called Spain in Europe that all of a sudden decided that they wanted to promote solar. And they got into it in a big way, and they turned their spigot off on that program in less than 9 months. That kind of knee-jerk reaction is what we want to be avoiding here, and I'm not saying that we're doing that, but you can see the detrimental impacts that choices like that do happen, and I think those are the kinds of things that you certainly would want to be avoiding. The third thing is to help existing businesses transition. There are many businesses here in Oregon that have intellectual properties and technical expertise that have served them well in our traditional core industries that we've had here. Those capabilities are adaptable in many of the new clean technology industries that are coming here to Oregon. For example, if you look at United Streetcar or Oregon Ironworks and their transition into making wave energy buoys, or you think about them with their streetcar projects, much of that involves welding. It involves metal fabrication work, material science. This is no different than had you been doing that kind of work for the pulp and paper industry. The skill sets are the same. The particular applications start to look different. There are other companies, for example, that have been in the supply chain for the RV industry in the Mid-Valley that have been hurt over the last recession. Those companies, whether they are in fiberglass work or in other components, have special skills that are applicable to, for example, servicing the wind farm industry that is happening here, both on the on both sides of the Columbia River in both Oregon and Washington. The wind farm industry is growing from 1,000 megawatts today and is forecasted to be 3, 4, 5,000 megawatts. It's a big number by the end of this decade. And those wind farms, over time, will need servicing. And who better than local businesses to take advantage of that? They have the expertise. Again, it's a matter of transitioning. And I think those are the kinds of areas that are opportunities. Today, as we speak, there are 10 Oregon companies that have grouped together, and they are at the American Wind Energy Association trade show in Washington, in Dallas, Texas, promoting their capabilities. And I think those are the kinds of steps that are going to be important as we help our existing businesses here transition into the new opportunities with the skill sets that they particularly own. There was a comment earlier this morning about having more sites and more buildings ready for development. 5 or 6 years ago, there was a key initiative on project-ready sites and getting that siting work done. That has done very well. We had a number, I believe, 50 sites that were declared project-ready. Many of those sites have now been used up. They have been successful in creating jobs. We need the next batch of sites to become project ready. And again, in that last batch, a lot of the easier sites to develop were developed as project ready, and now we're into a little bit more of the difficult sites. But those are the kinds of things that would help with getting the infrastructure ready. And as a utility company, we are in partnership with many of the state and public agencies to get these sites ready. But the initiative really needs to be done by the public sector in many of these instances. I want to also mention and talk a little bit about workforce realities. The workforce is increasingly becoming a key decider on whether a company decides to have a business operation here or to expand here in our state. One-third of the jobs in today's economy requires a four-year college degree. And yet, we talk about in our education system as either it's college or else. And I think it's time that we offer up another alternative, which is the professional development degree or a professional certificate. Those kinds of jobs, I'm talking about everywhere from the crafts to the electricians to the plumbers to people that fabricate metals to run CNC equipment, are all key to the future growth and development of our economy. And those are the kinds of jobs that will create revenues to our state coffers. And so avoiding or moving away from the either it's college or else into a it's a college, it's a professional certificate or a technical professional degree that doesn't require that four-year degree or else may be the much better option. And I know that Duncan Wise from the Oregon Business Council has been talking about the 40-40-20 plan, but I think something along those lines to really get our workforce focused on, again, the businesses that are here today and helping them with their transitions into these new opportunities that are coming out in front. Finally, the one thing that I noticed in when we have discussions about revenue impacts and we talk about offering incentive programs of that sort, we also talk about revenue impacts always sort of in the negative sense, that this is the reduction in state impact in state revenues, and we talk about it that way. But there's an upside to it also. By offering incentives or promotions or other reasons for businesses to invest here, jobs are created over many years, and there is an income stream to state coffers from that over a period of time. And that's the plus side. And I think it is the combination of the two that is really the revenue impact that we should be thinking about, just not what the impact is when the incentive program is granted to a business for doing the kinds of things that we look for them to do. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Chair Schauffler, members of the committee, my name is Tashiana Wengler. I'm a Pacific Corps Government Affairs representative. And just a little bit about the company. As you might know, Pacific Corps is an electric utility. We serve just over 555,000 customers in Oregon as Pacific Power. And hopefully you can see from the map that we do have a pretty large footprint in Oregon. We're in southern Oregon on the coast, in eastern Oregon, and also a portion of Portland. We are making a large number of investments. We're investing in renewable energy resources. By the end of this year, we'll have approximately 1,700 megawatts of renewable resources in our portfolio. We're also investing in approximately $6.1 billion in transmission across the West, what we call our Gateway Transmission Project. And in March, we entered into a memorandum of understanding with Idaho Power to explore a partnership on the 300-mile Boardman-Hemingway Transmission Project in eastern Oregon. We believe renewable energy and transmission investment can stimulate economic development in the state. And we have three specific suggestions for the way that the state can generate job creation as it relates to utilities and energy. First, we believe that it would be beneficial to take a look at the Energy Facility Siting Council. It really plays a large role in ensuring investment and resources in the state. For example, one way that the process could be improved and become more efficient is if there is a federal review and a state review required for a transmission line, say it crosses over federal lands, a federal review is required. Those processes could be all combined into one process, and that would definitely create efficiencies. I'm sure there's other ways to assure efficiency and streamline the process, and we'd be interested in looking at that with the state. Secondly, Oregon is pretty lucky as far as its energy rates. It might be a little bit tough to see the numbers on this map. But the average retail rate for electricity in the United States in 2008 was a little over 9.5 cents, whereas in Oregon it was just a little over 7 cents. You can compare that with the tiered rates in California that range from 28 cents up to 49 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a pretty large differential. So as policymakers look at developing new energy policies, we hope that they keep in mind the way that rates have an impact on economic development and really look to support and maintain our competitive energy prices. And then, as my counterpart mentioned, developing business-ready sites, we think that utilities can play a large role in that process. One specific program is the Industrial Lands Certification Program. And we think that utilities could be better integrated into that process so that you identify the sort of infrastructure upgrades that are necessary to have a business-ready site early in the process. And support planning for upgrades that need to be done. And I believe a gentleman from the ports mentioned the Special Public Works Fund, and just one example of how we've used that program, or actually worked with the city of Millersburg when they used that program, is they've developed sites to site industrial businesses, and we've worked with them to identify the energy infrastructure needs, and that program really worked well for them, so we support that program. And then outside of state programs to support it, we just have worked directly with businesses to site their businesses in areas that make sense. For example, you may have heard in the news recently, Facebook is coming to Prineville, Oregon. And they contacted us early to ask us what sort of sites we had available that would make most sense for them. We identified a few sites and then eventually chose Prineville. And from that, they've guaranteed 35 new long-term jobs. So those are just a few of our ideas, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. There are those out there that think we should have $5 and $6 gas and that those rates should skyrocket so that people will be forced into using less energy. I'm not among them, and I hope our rates do stay moderate where they are. I'm not interested in tearing down dams. I'm interested in retrofitting them and continuing to use it. I think we should take a good look again at siting nuclear in this state again. I know there's some heartburn there from some of our power providers, but you know, with this new technology, I think I think we should take a look at it. That's my humble opinion. And I also think we need to get a little realistic about these renewable goals we have. I think they were drawn up with the intention of increasing the cost of power, just for the same reason logic I just shared with you, which I don't share. They want to drive it up so people use less, force us into using less energy. I think people can take care of their own thermostat at home, and I want that those rates to stay modest and moderate so that not only industry can thrive, but so grandma can afford to keep the heat on. With that, any questions of these very good people? I love my electricity, by the way. You're doing a fine job, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a simple question. Why would Oregon power be 20% less than... I mean, why would Idaho power be 20% less than Oregon?
Oh, no.
I can try. I guess I don't have a specific answer to your question regarding why Idaho would have such lower rates. It may be due to Bonneville Power, but I'm sorry. I don't know if you have a better answer.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Cameron, I believe that's part of the infrastructure. The hydroelectric facilities in Idaho were built many, many years ago, and they have taken advantage of that. They haven't had to build very many new facilities for a while, but I also understand that they're hitting that point where they may be needing to build more. So you have that price differential based on the legacy of the facilities and just the age of them.
So just to follow up, if I may. Yeah, so the Oregon has made newer investments, which has driven our cost up.
Our population's
I think I do. Yeah, and now I'm going on memory, but I believe that we have more recent investments in large power plants than other states do. So there is a timing issue that is at play.
Well, it's not due to regulatory or anything like that, or any rules or standards or goals that we've implemented legislatively. It's due to the infrastructure they enjoy. Well, like Washington has a larger population, maybe theirs is less. Whatever they're doing, I want to find out. We need to do it here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't have the answer to that question?
As the
two largest power distributors in the state of Oregon?
I think at this point it would only be guessing on my part, but I'd be happy to look into it and get an answer for you.
Oh, come on up, Mr. Bolton. Here he comes to save the day.
Comes my boss. So.
She's doing a fine job, boss.
Mr. Chair, committee member Scott Bolton for Pacific Corp. Regional disparities in prices have a lot to do with state regulatory policies, no doubt about it. With respect to Idaho, I can't say specifically for Idaho, but there's a number of factors that would go into the types of utilities that serve Idaho. So, for instance, there are two large investor-owned utilities in the state, but it's mainly smaller cooperative utilities that serve the state that have significant benefit from the BPA system that is a low-cost generation resource. So that's part of the reason why, you know, in a slide that might be a little bit dated in 2008 statistics, does show under the previous BPA contracts that they did have pretty low generation going into the state. And that's the factor for Washington as well. Washington has almost 50% of its population served by larger investor-owned utilities, but there's, I think, over 60 utilities in total in the state, some incredibly small, and some of which that are full requirements customers of the Bonneville system. So there is a difference in how Bonneville Power Administration benefits and that low-cost hydro resource is distributed among Northwest states. And that's probably the largest single factor that goes into rate differentials among the states. The other thing I would call your attention to, though, is looking at how expensive California is, and that California represents not just a higher cost place to do business, but also a marketplace that has 10 times the population of Oregon. And so there are trade-offs with that. Should make, you would think, Oregon a more attractive place to draw business as long as we manage our costs well and are competitive against that marketplace.
Thank you. Any further questions? These nice people. All righty then. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming. All righty then. Mr. Leahy, you want to come on up here and share some of your experiences with this great state with us? I just want to start off by saying I'm really sorry how you've been treated in this state. All right? Well, I think it's a criminal.
Thank you, Representative Shuffler and committee.
Thank you.
I'm Ken Leahy. I own Ken Leahy Construction. Been in business for 43 years. We're in heavy construction. We build streets and roads and golf courses and do infrastructure work for shopping centers and so on. It's been quite an experience here lately. We've, over the years, employed between 75 and 80 people. Right now, we're down to 10. I remember the early 80s, the tough time there. That was a regional dilemma. Now we're all in this bowl of soup together. I think we're still in business. We're one of the lucky ones. Our competition is falling like flies. I think there have been 8 of our competitors that have been in the last year that have went out of business. And if it wasn't for what we're doing ourselves, we would be one of those statistics. The public sector market out there, such as streets, roads, and utilities, is really competitive. And I had a talk with our bonding company here about 2-3 months ago. The bids that are going out for these public jobs are ending up being about half of what an engineer's estimate would be. So what that means is these jobs are going to be, as time goes on, the bonding companies are going to be ending up finishing them. They just can't do that. We bid one here about a month ago, and we took and cut our equipment in half, our markup between 2% and 5%. We were 12th out of 14. It went for half of what the engineer's estimate was about. So it can't continue. So what I see happening here is it's going to be a while before things turn around. I mean, we're sitting there with our motor idling. The good thing about us is we've been in business long enough and quite frugal in managing our equipment and our facilities and everything. So we do have a little bit of cushion, and I've been able in the last 10 years to go out and do some private development myself, which has enabled us to have the construction company work as a sub to us, which has kept us going. Now, the other thing, I bought Bradwood 23 years ago. We bought it for the purpose of putting in a rock quarry. We got it permitted for a rock quarry because we want to do some riprap and jetty work on the rivers. We have not since done that because we were unsuccessful in bidding some of that work coming along. There have been several occasions over the years to take in industry, one of which was, maybe you folks have heard of it, the Great Wolf Lodge that's up in Washington now. About 10 years ago, I catered them for about a year and a half. They did a feasibility study in the whole 9 yards. When they got done, we went to the county. It would have been a beautiful facility for a destination resort, right on the Columbia, fishing, marina, I mean, all this sort of thing. We went to the county. That was about 10 years ago. They didn't want to change it from industrial to recreation, so we had to leave that one go. About 7 years ago, when Northern Star came, I didn't know anything about LNG, but I took and researched it a little bit. I went back to Boston. They have a plant back there in Everett, Massachusetts, that has been there since 1971. The same thing that we want to put in there. 2 big tanks. The ships come up the Mystic River, dump a load, 2 loads a week, and they go. We got a letter from the mayor of Everett. He says, "Man," he says, "it's kind of an inconvenience at times with the big ships in there, but the revenue was tremendous. About $8 million a year they get off of tax revenue, which Clatsop County could get." I mean, it's just unbelievable what we went through for 6 years, $150 million. Will business come to Oregon? I mean, they're going to look at, this is a national disgrace. Is business going to look at that and look how we've been abused? And are they going to come here and put up that sort of nonsense? No. It's terrible. And until the corruption is cleaned up from the top down, we're wasting our time. We really are. And when I say from the top down, just check it out. It's coming. The train wreck is coming. The regulatory agencies are impossible to deal with. We did an industrial project in Tualatin in Washington County about 2 years ago. We had a wetland that was probably the size of your automobile. We had to do a complete study of that, hired a wetlands biologist. By the time we got done with DEQ, Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries, the city and the county, it held us up for 6 months and close to $150,000, not including the time loss. I mean, that just, it goes on and on and on. If the agencies say that they're going to take 60 days or 90 days to give you, get a response back to you, you can guarantee that it's not going to happen before then. And if you push them, you get to the bottom of the pile. It's that way. We tried to pass a Senate bill to limit these agencies to a time to respond, not to approve a project, but to respond. That didn't even come out and hit the floor. I mean, that wouldn't even be for our project. It'd be for all the projects, public works, streets, roads, everything. These agencies are just got a stranglehold on everything. So, I mean, a lot of things have got to be done. I don't know the answer to all of it. As far as the labor industry goes, I think it's very important. Everyone doesn't need a college education. There's got to be more trade schools. We're in the construction industry. We see people coming, applying for work that have a higher education that couldn't run a number two shovel. I mean, it's that way. I mean, it's kind of pathetic. So I attached a deal, what we went through in Clatsop County, and I won't go into that, about the recall laws in the state. It's just criminal what these commissioners in Clatsop County have went through. And if this continues to happen, these environmental groups, they get a hold of things and they just run with it, and it's terrible. I went back to Washington, D.C. about a year and a half ago to talk to David Wu to find out why he was so against LNG. It was the most pathetic answer I've ever heard. I just got to listen to the people. I mean, when you got people like that in Washington, it was pathetic. And what I did find out is a group of these anti-people come back there, and he thought they were going to have to get security to throw him out of his office. That's what you're dealing with. I think that's about all I have. Is any questions?
Well, once again, I'm really sorry about how you've been treated in this state. And you know, there's 250,000 people out there that don't have a job, and I don't think anybody's listening to them, to be quite frank with you. Now, there are people that come in here and say, oh, yeah, we're doing X, Y, and Z, and it's far too little, far too late. And to turn our noses up at hundreds of building trades jobs, 85 full-time jobs, a 50% increase on that county's tax base, when people are literally begging out there for food stamps. It's just criminal. And it's all a commodity and a utility that we all use. All of us use it. So I could go on and on. Any questions of this fine American here? All right, sir. Representative Whitten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken, over the six-year period leading up to the bankruptcy of Northern Star, what did you see from your vantage point as some of the key roadblocks to development that we as a committee ought to be considering for in terms of future economic development?
Well, one of them is you know, like the DEQ permit or the application was in there for a year and a half before they even reviewed it. And then when they started to review it, who did they hire? Somebody in direct conflict, the American Federated Tribes, I guess. They hired a consultant from them who's a direct relationship to the river keepers. Then they look at it and they say, well, this is a two-dimensional report. We need a three-dimensional report. So we went back out there and did a three-dimensional report for another 6 months, another $700,000. And it's just unbelievable. I mean, it just goes on and on. The corruption through the permitting process has been there since day one from just about every agency that we're dealing with, except the county of Clatsop County. Those poor people, the commissioners, have to be, I mean, the minute that they approved that project, it said recall. And it was just pathetic how what they went through. So that's something that you really want to look at, and that's something that's got to be changed.
Representative Whitten, you have a follow-up, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm maybe as much a comment as a question, but I'm concerned that some agencies have an ability to pick the goalpost up and move it, and that some of the good folks that are trying to entertain economic development in this state are never able to get the ball across the line because somehow, someplace, somewhere, these agencies, as I say, have an ability to keep moving that goalpost no matter how good you are. And I don't know what we need to do, Mr. Chairman, to make sure that everybody understands the rules of the game and how big the field is when they come to play.
You know, we need to get to people to yes in a timely fashion rather than the system is being manipulated to get people to no. That's what it is for every ill activist out there. And that's what's going on here. It's pure manipulation. The lies and the deceit over critical salmon habitat, bilge water, the fact that it's going to harm farmland. I have a sewer pipe that goes right through back of my backyard. You wouldn't know that pipe's there unless I told you. There's gas lines crisscrossing the entire country. No one would even know they're there unless you told them. But it's been manipulated. It's just criminal. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you. And I can relate a little bit to what I think your meaning of corruption is. I'm going to give you an example. In a municipality that I know of, they held up a permit process for a building permit until the owner of the property signed an easement across his property for ingress, egress of traffic to the properties that were next to his. That's the kind of stuff I think you're talking about, aren't you?
Exactly, yes.
I mean, and that's just extortion. And it's being done today.
Yeah. I think we definitely have to respond to an applicant for a building permit in a timely fashion. That's what we need to do. And these are the rules. Here's what you need to comply with and move on. Not continue to move the goalpost, create more hoops to jump through to get people to work here in the state. Do you have any final comments?
Yes.
Move on.
Chairman Sheffler, I think to streamline the permitting process, if somehow there was one person responsible for all permitting, and it goes down from there. You get this done, you get that done. That's the only way it's going to happen.
That's because you run a job site, and that's not what people are about around here.
Yeah. I hate doing things like that.
That's how I do it. My business, too.
And you're right about the shovel. They wouldn't know what to do with it if you hit them upside the head with it. I appreciate you coming down here and sharing with us today. I really do, and hopefully something positive will come out.
Mr. Chair, I nominate you to be that person.
Okay. I'm for clean water. There we go. We're moving on. Thanks for coming, Mr.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay, I got three more folks. My union brothers, John Molis, Bob Shipwreck, and Duke Shepherd. And we're doing good on time, folks. I'm very proud of this committee for not talking as much as I do.
So we limit and Shipwreck?
We haven't followed a bad example.
Whoever wants to go first, guys.
I was handed that task, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council, and I have been fascinated by the testimony you're hearing today. It's a long time coming. I had some prepared remarks, but I just got some news that I don't know. You guys, with your computers, just released the latest revenue forecast. Did you all see that?
I'm not seeing it.
You're down $847 million since the end of last session.
Unbelievable.
$800 million less in personal income taxes. So it kind of adds a little bit more importance to what we're talking about here today, because you're going to have to take some very, very bold action now. This state is in free fall with the job creation problem that we've got. I've never seen, and I wanted to just say, I really appreciate one thing that the building trades have always respected and try to assist is the ag and timber communities, because we are one state, and those industries that do well by us. We're all in this together, so I want to just make that for the record, and we're always going to be there to assist those industries. One of the things that I was going to talk about, and I'm going to be brief here, Mr. Leahy brought it up. Several sessions ago, we worked on some legislation to do supersiting of projects. Essentially, just take one agency and literally, as Ken said, this DEQ, you do this, Fish and Wildlife, you do this, LCDC, you do this. We're going to supersite this. We're going to do the building permit. We're going to issue you a permit and take it out of going from one to one to one to one to one. Dramatically speed. That law, I believe, is on the books. It's just not being used. Enough has been said today about state agency action. It's very frustrating. It seems, just from an outsider's perspective, and I'm a fan of government, but there are some things that seem to be looked on with favor and some that are, they're not treated the same. That's just a perception that I have. Some of the ideas I've been kicking around, I should mention we formed a labor management group, the AFL-CIO, Bill with the Carpenters, some of the major business associations, to try and come up with some ideas for the legislature. I've never seen labor and management in this state so connected right now. All differences are gone. We just need to get some people to work and stop the hemorrhaging and the bankruptcies. One of the things that I've thought about, I just thought I'd bring a couple ideas today and as we flesh more things out, but I was at yet another meeting just this last week on how do we fund commercial energy retrofits. It's really important. You guys have spent almost 2 years trying to figure out how to fund this. It still hasn't happened. It's low-hanging fruit. Businesses could upgrade their facilities, save a lot of money, put a lot of people to work right away in many of the crafts. And one of the ideas I had, and it's I guess a sign of the times where, oh, Bob, you can't do that, and the legislature. But you need to start looking at tough things. You're going to have to come up with some bold ideas. And one of the things I suggested to this group was to allow utilities to offset their RPS responsibilities by allowing them to do energy retrofits for businesses and government buildings. You're not going to meet those goals anyway, so why not incent the utilities to be able to go out and help businesses retrofit their businesses? It's an idea. I'm going to vet it through the utilities. I had a short message, and they said as long as it's not a mandate, and I said I'm with you on that. We've had enough mandates. The other thing that I was going to propose, got a lot of comment, was I was around when we passed the lottery law, video poker we called it in those days. It's expanded much more, and it was supposed to, those lottery funds were supposed to go for economic development. That's why the people supported it. Very little of it today goes for what I would call economic development. And I would suggest either the legislature spend at least 50% of all the lottery funds for job creation, and or refer something to the people to let them choose whether or not 50% or more of that money should be used for direct job creation. I think it would pass. Just in winding up, I had to laugh at the farmer from Klamath Falls. I mean, how could you have two more disparate people, myself and this farmer from Klamath Falls, but he put it right on the money. We study, 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 study. All we do is study. There is one area of growth, at least in where I'm from, where there's a lot of more employment, and that's planners. We've got them stacked like cordwood up there. And we need to start having some deciders instead of planners. And I'm not going to belabor, Bill Cluding eloquently put it, on Columbia River Crossing, Mr. Leahy, Bradwood Landing, just two recent examples of something being studied to death and no jobs at the end of the day. The last thing I would echo, and I had a bill last session that frankly really surprised me at the reaction it got. It was called the Buy American Bill. You know, one of the things we could do in this country and in this state is start buying things from our own businessmen. But we don't do that. And just as an example, and then I'm done, we're actively seeking to bring in solar panel manufacturers from all over the country, and we're doing a pretty good job at it. But all we do is put up Chinese solar panels on all these government buildings. What is that about? Why do we do things like that? We should be buying stuff that's made here that are creating jobs instead of going to India and China. And I was shocked at the response I got, particularly from local government. As long as it's their low bid, they don't care where it comes from. But those are just some of my thoughts. I hope we have some more hearings like this. I hope that our little groups, and I hope this group behind me sticks together and we come back to you, because you're going to need a lot of ideas, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't envy your position at all. You're going to have some tough, tough decisions to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We have about 225,000 members, union and non-union, working and unemployed. And this is a great hearing today, because for us, right, this isn't about what percentage of the workforce is going to be union or non-union. We need a middle class in this state, and who's union and who isn't will work itself out based on the decisions other people make after the jobs are created. But right now, we're not creating any jobs. And being at the end today, after sitting through a lot of compelling testimony, you know, as Bob said, you get people from different backgrounds, different life experiences, different industries. I haven't heard a lot today that any of us would disagree with, I think, with each other, from ag to labor to construction. And I'll just kind of, the pieces that I had were largely spoken to already, but just so we're officially on the record as being on the same page. Streamlining, having a streamlined, understandable permitting process in the state would be incredibly helpful. Whether you think we've got enough or not enough, processes that are created over decades need to be revisited, and everything can constantly be improved. And at the very least, we should be asking all the time, what can we do better? What can we do better? And the folks who have to go through this, I don't have to go through a permitting process. I've heard from a lot of people who do, and we should be listening to them very objectively about each step they have to go through from the federal, state, and local level, because they all add up, and only a portion of it gets solved here at the state. We need to aggressively pursue the ability to harvest our timber in the state. And there is an environmental angle to this. From what I've read, trees max out their carbon sequestration at 55 years. After that, it declines. And when the tree falls down or when it burns, it lets off carbon. So if you harvest it and it's a product, it's holding that carbon. This is holding carbon. So let's build stuff, let's harvest wood, and let's use what we've got in this state. And we have to find some kind of middle ground on getting basic infrastructure built, whether it's power lines or pipelines, roads, bridges. PacifiCorp had great suggestions. You know, we've got great hydropower in the state, but if we wanted to build those dams and run those power lines now, we couldn't. You know, everybody wants green power, but the electrons still have to go over wires. And I'm not a utility person, but just the things I hear about how difficult it's becoming to do any of this basic kind of infrastructure that used to get done in this country and in the state is pretty remarkable. A specific that I would point back to is was House Bill 3058 in 2009, which was linear fill removal permits, which was erroneously and hysterically called the LNG Fast Track Bill. I think you heard from Mr. Leahy, that bill would not have sped up that process. It sure wouldn't have prevented Northern Star from going out of business. We still need that bill for other infrastructure. So now that LNG is, at least that project's off the table, I hope we can get back to what was an important bill and bring that back next session.
You're going to see it if I'm reelected.
All right. And likewise, the Columbia River Crossing, every Western Star truck built by Freightliner that gets shipped out of this country goes over that bridge. So, and I haven't talked to Freightliner, but I've talked to the workers there. If you're looking long-term at expanding a facility, do you want your costs to go up because you can't get trucks over a bridge? And that's, again, a place where hopefully the state can maybe help to kick things into gear, because it's been a ridiculously paralyzed process there. It does not bode well for the future when you've got an interchange in the Portland area, Interstate 84, I-5, there's a huge bottleneck. If you can't get a bridge built, you're not going to entangle the other roadblocks that we have all up and down this state. And the workforce issues that were brought up, those have been constant when the economy is good or the economy is bad. I don't have the answer there, but I do think it is telling that whether the economy is booming or the economy is bad, the issues keep coming up. And it gets back to what Representative Kennemer mentioned. If we keep doing the same stuff and we keep getting the same results, we've got to figure out other stuff to do. And that would conclude my remarks. Thank you.
You know, that report of $800 million, you know, we're going to have to work our way out of this. We're not going to raise those taxes. It's not going to happen. We can't defy gravity. I'm sorry, John. I'm sorry. No, go ahead. No.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Secretary Treasurer for the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council, serving Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon. And first, I would like to thank Chair Schauffler for your opening remarks. And with your permission, I'd like to give you two real-life examples of how this economic downturn has affected construction workers in Oregon. First is about 2 weeks ago, I spoke with an electrician out at Local 48's hall at their solar panel dedication. He's worked 70 days in the last year and a half. The project that he's on will wind down next month. The contractor that he's working for has no other work on the books, so he anticipates being laid off. He'll go back to the hall and sign the out-of-work list. He anticipates he'll be there for a year and a half to 2 years before he receives another call to go back to work. The second example, I spoke with a medium-sized electrical contractor in the Portland area about a month and a half ago. He told me that he has 25% of his pre-recession workforce working full-time. The rest of them are either laid off or working 8 hours this week, 32 the next week, 16 the following week, whatever they can get their hands on. So I very much share your frustrations. It seems like some elected officials and far too many bureaucrats are far more interested in slowing down and stymieing and stopping projects rather than giving these projects a fair shake, a fair permit process, and allowing them to move forward and putting our members to work who are currently about 35 to 40% unemployed. Bob and Duke, I think, did a great job of hitting on some specifics, and so I'm just going to touch on four kind of big picture items very briefly. A couple of these have already been mentioned, but I just see them as being very important. The first one is availability of shovel-ready land, and the example I like to use is Genentech. They're a pharmaceutical finish and fill, a pharmaceutical company that built a finish and fill facility in Hillsboro over the last few years. They bought 75 acres a few years ago. They've invested several hundred million dollars here. That several hundred million dollars investment took 12 acres out of the 75 that they purchased. My point is they didn't buy 12 acres saying that's what we need for now, and 5 or 10 years from now we'll look across the street or someplace else and see if we can find another 5 or 10 acres. They bought 75 acres because that's their long-term business plan, and I hope they're successful, and I hope they keep creating these high-paying jobs, and they were a great customer for the building trades to work for. But unless we have 75, 100, 150-acre shovel-ready parcels of land available for these companies, they will go elsewhere. The second one, just very briefly, is the tax policy in our state. Bob hit that hammer home. The 2011 session, I hope we can come up with some kind of sensible, sustainable tax system. All the incentives, I'm sure, are going to be on the table, and the ones that help create jobs, I'm supportive of, and I'm sure there's ones that don't work that will probably have to go away. The second two that I'm going to touch on have been affected by some of the volunteer work that I do. I'm honored to serve as one of five volunteer commissioners for the Portland Development Commission. One of the very difficult issues that startup firms face in the state is lack of venture capital. It seems like the small companies that are really trying to get started to be in a biotech and some of these emerging fields that could potentially become the next Microsoft or Genentech or Intel, they can't get their hands on money in this state. And so too many times they leave the state, or they get started, get their feet on the ground, get rolling, hire a dozen people, and can't hit that next step, and the next thing you hear about, they're moving to the Bay Area or Seattle or someplace else where they can't get the capital that they need. And I think that's partially tied back to our tax structure. And the last thing I would ask is that you maintain funding for Oregon Inc. That's the Oregon Innovation Council. They work to help recruit businesses that help create high-paying jobs. And really that loops me right back to my first two, because if they can't find land and they don't view Oregon as having a sensible tax policy, they're going to go someplace else. So, Mr. Chairman, I very much appreciate the invitation to testify today. Thank you, and I look forward to working with you in the future, and I'll do my best to answer any questions.
And, you know, there's going to be a flurry of legislation, and the Speaker and the Senate President have to get those concepts to the right committees, work those bills, pass them to the floor, and it's as easy as this to vote yes, and none of this monkey business. And then the governor, whomever it is, has to sign it. And we need to get I cannot. If anybody's listening to this, it's abundantly clear why we are $800 million in the hole. Abundantly clear. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've talked and talked about land use process here in the state of Oregon, and when I was president of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, I had an individual that was putting a facility in the area, and he said, and I'll never forget this, "I'm coming to Oregon in spite of your land use laws." So that kind of sums it up. The other thing is, how many states have adopted a centralized land use process? Not one other state. We need to look at that, because we've gotten it to the point of where we have bureaucrats that are making rules on top of rules that are contradictory to other rules, and not one individual thoroughly understands them. We always rank 30 to 40 in all the ratings I've seen as business friendly. I'm just adamant about that. Even Alec rates us in the latter 30s for business friendly. We also why, if the business climate's so great in Oregon, why are we the last, one of the top five always in unemployment in the last couple of years? Why isn't our unemployment dropping? It's stagnant. This economy's stagnant. $800 and some million tells you, folks, we have a problem in this state, and we cannot do it by taxing our way out of a recession. I understand right now, according to one of our candidates for governor, that we're 47th in job creation out of 50. That's pretty anemic, folks, and you'll never have a good economy if you have that type of a status. We've talked about the tail wagging the dog in this state, where the people, of course, the minority of the people, use our court system to tie up our natural resources, and that's something that this legislative body, I hope, weighs in on. And more importantly, I'd love to see them weigh in on it, because then we'd find out really who cares about Oregon workers and who doesn't.
Representative, I ask you to wrap it up, because some other people might have something to say. I love what you're saying.
And the last thing I have to say is two things. Actually, not one last thing, but everyone in the state cannot work for the government. Okay? The other thing is that what's the incentive for people to go back to work? A friend of mine lost his job, went on subsistence from the state of Oregon and the federal government, and he's figured out it's going to cost him money if he goes to work for less than $17.50 an hour. What's the incentive? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, my pleasure, Representative. Any other comments or questions of these gentlemen? Representative Matthews.
Just a general comment, not for the individuals, if you don't mind, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You,
thank you. And thank you for your testimony. And thanks to all for the testimony. We had a room filled earlier, and they're not here, but I'm sure as word travels through this building, it'll get to them as well. You know, it's no doubt with the number 847 that that'll climb, and we're going to be into a big situation. It's going to be tough decisions. Those are decisions that we will all have to make. And I guess my only point would be that we heard through today, and I think it was from Weyerhaeuser, Mr. Miller had made mention that we have to make sure that when we do policy that we're getting it right. We can't be, you know, taking things on a fast track, trying to get it right, hoping that it's right, only the next session be sitting here and saying, here, we want to make an improvement. We have a unintended consequence of bill whatever. And so I want to make sure it's right. But ultimately what I want to say is I think it's going to be absolutely important and imperative that we all look for the solution, be open to the suggestions, and find a way to work together. The answer to all these problems isn't on who's in charge over here, who's in charge over there. It's within the seats here and within this building to say, what's going to be the way to move Oregon forward? And I'll use the analogy of sports. I know that Derek Bradley is sitting in my office right now. He knows this is coming. But you think about baseball. You know, it's fun to swing for the fence and hit a home run, but the game is won on base hits. Bottom line is you got to get runners on bases, and that's how you win. And we need to move forward, and we need to work together. And I would just encourage every group out there not to dismiss somebody's philosophy or their responsibility based on party line. I would say approach us all on your ideas. Approach us all. Spend some time. And I say that, Mr. Chair, because I was reminded by a group that I voted less than 70% on their issues. But when I asked them about how much time they spent with me to educate me on their issues, they had to admit it was little to none. And it's because they had the 31 they needed to move it forward, whether or not it was for the good of Oregon. Some of those policies, quite honestly, I would have been in favor of. But because they were unwilling to amend and they didn't feel the need to, they simply just passed through. So I would just say that as we move forward together, not by party line, not by who's in charge, but because it's the right thing for Oregon to do. And I apologize, too, for you, Mr. Leahy, to go through what you did as a company. That's unfortunate. We dealt with a similar situation with, I think it was Douglas County with the Metolius, where they were moving forward, and then that came to a stop in this building. So I just want to say thanks again, Mr. Chair. If I'm back here in January, you'll count on my support. We need to move forward, and thank you all again for your testimony and shining the light where it needs to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else? Good. All right. Well, guys, thanks. Bring all your ideas. Let's get it on.
Yep.
All right. I got 2 minutes. Joe, you want to come up and say a few words? I got 2 minutes for you.
No, I don't, because I had two of my members just...
All right, Ian. Very good. Well, then, I appreciate everybody. Without anything else for the good of the order, a representative.
Mr. Chair, is there any validity to the rumor that the D's are grooming you to replace Lars Larson?
It'd be a fun show to be on. Anyway, with that, we're adjourned.